walk themselves in, excuse me, steps where then to proceed with Christians to learn work and then put the work on their own. Question number 92. Question number 93, the honorable children letter. The speaker, in the interest of environment change, is a devoted Spanish Finnish task force has now finalized with the new energy action plan as stated in the new ERDF program plan, and so will the honorable minister provide a copy to Parliament. Answer the honorable minister for health, the environment and energy.
Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 94 to 97.
Question number 94, the Honourable J.J. Leslie.
Speaker, in the Minister for Environment State, from which renewable sources we are currently obtaining 2.1 megawatts per year of renewable energy as stated in the post-fire ERDF operational program 2014-2020, taking the individual amounts by each source and whether this is to be used by the government or privately.
Question number 95, the Honourable J.J. Leslie.
Speaker, given the statement on page 11 of the ERDF operational program in which it states that Gibraltar is an excellent place for placing solar and wind production, can the Minister for Environment say if any wind turbines are envisaged to be erected during this wind program and so provide a statement to Parliament?
Question number 96, the Honourable J.J. Leslie.
Speaker, can the Minister for Environment say if we have already had a project that has been partly funded or in the process of being funded through the new ERDF program, and if so, could the Honourable Minister provide details of that?
Question number 97, the Honourable J.J. Leslie.
Speaker, can the Minister for Environment say if the government or any other organization working for the government is likely to obtain any funding from the new ERDF program as a result of the new power station to be built?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to question number 3, yes, Mr. Speaker. A copy of the plan will be provided electronically during the course of this afternoon. The figure included in the ERDF program report indicating that 3.1 megawatts per year was being generated from renewable sources was based on a previously estimated forecast baseline that Gibraltar would be generating approximately 0.002% of its total electricity requirement from renewable energy sources. The figure should have been correctly expressed at 310,000 kilowatt hours per year. Moreover, it should be stressed that the figure used was an estimate, since forecasting the actual electrical output from renewable per annum is as difficult, particularly in solar power, as trying to forecast the weather for a whole year. The actual recorded production of renewable energy fed into the network in 2013, and this is the first time this has ever been done, was 123,880.5 kilowatt hours. With the exception of the solar photovoltaic system set up in Pavilion Jackson Grove and the swimming pool, which are operated by private companies, all the remaining sources were produced by the Gibraltar Electrical Authority. The complete breakdown is as follows. With the Gibraltar swimming pool, 85,218 kilowatts. And bus stop, 17,798 kilowatt hours, so kilowatt hours. King's Wharf Compact, 2,706 kilowatt hours. The Frontier, 1,503 kilowatt hours. Various Streetlights, 601 kilowatt hours. And Sir William Jackson Grove, 16,054.5 kilowatt hours. The government is currently investigating the feasibility of installing wind turbines in both onshore and or offshore environments. It's currently not possible to ascertain whether any wind turbines will be erected during the new program period until all the required assessments are carried out, It's nevertheless the government's desire to generate renewable energy from wind turbines by the year 2018, as highlighted in the British National Renewable Energy Action Plan, of which a copy, as I said earlier, will be forwarded this afternoon. To date, there are no projects that have been partly funded or in the process of being funded under the new ERDF program. And finally, Mr. Speaker, there is no present intention for ERDF money to be used in the funding of the new power station.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for information given and also indeed for providing the report of that. In relation to one of the questions that is the possibility of introducing wind turbines, I think the Minister said that they're looking at a number of proposals onshore and offshore. Could perhaps the Minister elaborate a bit more in relation to the specific areas they're looking at to see whether this is feasible or not, at this point anyway?
Mr. Speaker, the wind turbine technology is progressing, now it's increasingly possible to generate a certain amount of wind energy from smaller plants, and also plants that rotate on a vertical axis rather than a horizontal axis, which obviously means there is no danger to those, which is a concern that I have often had, and we've had this conversation before from the Honourable Member of the People's Minister. And therefore, because of the possibility of smaller, non-dangerous wind turbines, there are a number of possibilities in the greater, which has to be assessed from the point of view of the wind and also the design. And there are, in fact, some wind turbines now that obviously look like artificial trees, and there are a number of locations, possibly the Europa Point area for that sort of thing. As far as offshore wind turbines are concerned, we are beginning a number of studies to ascertain wind velocity and reliability of wind, and these would clearly likely be, but this is not a commitment, off the east side of the delta. But it's very early stages yet. But because this technology is progressing, it's something that we need to look into for the future.
Great, Speaker. Could the Minister perhaps indicate whether any sort of possibilities currently have been provided to the government, to the Department of Environment, in relation of the possibility of installing some wind turbines at the detached mode and in the upper augmented reserve?
Mr. Speaker, I start with the last one. The upper augmented reserve for my land is not a suitable location because of the other types of environmental impact. There have been studies carried out in the past on the detached mode, and that is one area that one will have to consider. But I recall those studies from quite a way back. And those obviously are still there, but we're looking at other areas because, as we know, the detached mode has other possibilities as well for the future.
Exactly. That is precisely what I was thinking about when I was listening to the exchanges between the Honourable Minister and my colleague, Mr. Nugget. But there are studies that indicate that actually the best place to site wind turbines, and now even more so because you've got these vertical ones that operate almost like a corkscrew technology, even with the detached mode. And bear in mind that the government is the only government, it doesn't matter whether it's them or us, will have to have 20% renewable energy by 2020. Is that seems to us like a waste of space, actually locating the liquefied natural gas there. And I have to say that if we were to win the next election, that is precisely what we would be looking to use the detached mode in order to build these wind turbines, because it is the ideal location. I'm going to agree with you that there are these studies that appear to indicate that that is the best location in the water for wind technology.
If the number of people to win the next election, I can assure you, Mr. Speaker, that there will be less renewable energy than there is higher than there will be in this time. But anyway, there we are. I couldn't resist that one, Mr. Speaker. The studies at the time indicate that of the areas studied, the fact mode gives the attack team to be one of the best locations. I can't confirm whether it's the best because of my recollection isn't as acute as that, it's just a little while since I read the report. I'm clearly up to the possibility. At this point, I'm not sure whether offshore wind farms were being considered. These are obviously very expensive, and you have to measure up the investment and the return of that investment, and as technology progresses, it will be better. So that is a possibility. I won't comment on the location of liquid natural gas because the final decision on that, on where that would go, hasn't been taken, and obviously it's not a supplementary to this particular question, but it is a supplementary to other exchanges that there have been over the last few days.
Bear in mind that on this side of the house, we have been publishing our policies in relation to a number of areas where, in our view, we've been breaking away from past practices of keeping cars close to one step and publishing a policy that people can see what the DSB is about and what the DSB is going to be doing if it were to get into government well in advance of the general election. Now, I invite them to consider this policy that we feel is an effective one and would help is assisting the government to meet any government to meet its 20% quota by 2020. And it's having a system whereby private residences can plug into the distribution network and incentivize through tax incentives, for example, those private residences building, say, for example, a solar panel, so that if there is a net production of electricity by the private individual within his home, they can then effectively plug that into the system, so there are net producers of electricity, those homes, and then the government will give them some kind of credit, for example, in relation to electricity. And is that something that the government can consider as a policy of adoption for?
I claim some credit for the conversion of the member deputies to the environmental movement. You can't deny that. Mr. Speaker, it's a very good idea, but it's not just exclusively the member deputies' idea. We are, in fact, currently discussing the question of feed-in tariffs. For this sort of initiative. In fact, already this summer, I have said, some solar power being sent into the grid for the first time, but these are in government buildings, so obviously there isn't the same need for subsidy power. But absolutely, this will probably be rolled out, as I said, before the next election, so he won't be able to get the credit for it, whether or not he wins it.
I have to say that I didn't know that the government was thinking of doing this. It seems to me to be a good idea, just based on my reading that all of the officials were doing it. And I'm delighted that the government has, as it were, decided to adopt this particular policy, which is a policy that we were, in fact, going to be announcing ourselves when we announced how we would meet at the 20% requirement by 2020. And Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has spoken about wind turbines. The Honourable Gentleman has spoken, indeed, the government has installed solar panels as well. What other forms of renewable energy does the government envision it will be adopting in order to meet this 20% requirement by 2020?
Mr. Speaker, I have to be careful with you, but I guess too much away. I mean, it's not to be right in the Honourable Member's manifesto. The speed is clearly one. As we have announced, we have one initiative which is looking at wave energy, and we have one or two others, and I say one or two because I'm not sure whether one of those two is still on the cards, in which we are looking at the use of marine currents. The technology there is much newer and it's more completely tried and tested, but we are encouraging developers of this technology to come and use the water to carry out these tests. And we will shortly be carrying out some marine current surveys in off the southwest of Gibraltar to see whether there is enough to generate electricity from that source. So the wind, the sun, and the sea are the three main ones that I think will be applicable to Gibraltar.
Because I agree entirely with it, the whole regret, those are the three areas. May I invite the Honourable Gentleman that perhaps he might at least myself and also the Shadow Minister for the Environment and Connecticut, because it strikes me that this is one of those areas where perhaps it doesn't matter what government or what political persuasion there may be after the next election, but we could be with continuity of policy in respect of the policy in government. But there is an obligation, there is an obligation. I give way to Mr. McCready, do you want to give way?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I'm very happy to answer the way. I can confirm that there will be continuity of policy because we will be in the next election.
Well, Mr. Speaker, thank you very much for that comment. Since the Honourable Gentleman was stripped away from his most important portfolio, he's obviously got very little to say. Mr. Speaker, may I return to the main topic of the supplementary? I was attempting to meet with myself and his shadow on this side of the house to perhaps find cool ideas so that there is continuity of policy in terms of the environment looking forward 2020, where there is change this requirement for there to be the provision of 20% renewable energy. It's an invitation I make publicly to the Honourable Gentleman as a sign of good faith and also a sign of the constructive politics that we're talking about, particularly in this area.
Mr. Speaker, I've been teaching the members of this about the environment for several decades. I have no problem in continuing to do so.
Question number 98, the Honourable DOCC. Yes. I think you might be less constructive on this question. Mr. Speaker, how much is the government paid the successful constructor thus far in respect of a contract to build the new fire station?
I'll answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, no payment has yet been made.
Mr. Speaker, is the reason for that because effectively the government only has 52 million pounds worth of reserves, Mr. Speaker, and in fact can only borrow another 51 million pounds before it reaches the legal borrowing limit? And therefore, this government is yes, since and does not have the money in order to pay for the 77 million for the power station before the end of the financial year.
No, Mr. Speaker, no, sorry. The first payment, as far as the agreement is concerned, is not due to April.
So is that the same for the request that means that the government has made of this particular company, that no invoices are submitted until after the 31st of March, because prior to the 31st of March, the government is free and doesn't have the money to pay for outlays of the state.
Remember that I became minister responsible for energy 2 days before we signed the contract, so it's not very little time to put that one out. So the arrangements were made prior to that, but I am absolutely certain that this is just part of this program and that the relevance of it is honourable member of the discussion is just limited.
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, can you confirm that the £77 million for this particular power station, and indeed it's going to be near £140 million, actually slightly more than £140 million, for a variety of reasons. But let's just consider the £77 million. But the £77 million is going to be paid out of the consolidated fund, and that no money that has been deposited by the government or called by the government to put from credit finance to devote to investment holding unity is going to be used in order to pay for this particular project.
Mr. Speaker, I would have thought so, but I have answered the question. This is the supplementary that I don't think I have to answer, but I don't think it's relevant. No payments have been made, and the intricacies of how the payments have been made do not fall under my area of responsibility, and therefore I think that that should be asked more specifically again on a future occasion.
Question number 91, the Honourable Edmund Willis.
Mr. Speaker, in the Minister's Health Crisis, I remember particularly related injuries first year 5 years in the Department of the Hospital on a multi-month basis for the last 5 years.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, the information is not accessible as it's recorded as a road traffic accident and is not specifically recorded as a cycling accident. So I'm not able to provide that information.
In the context of everything we were discussing this morning, we're not going to be able to think before this afternoon.
Is looking at the possibility of somehow categorizing incidents in that way is something that the government might look at? Thank you. So, Mr. Speaker, on receiving this answer, it became apparent that there are some categories that could be subdivided more greatly. Clearly, we don't want the staff at A&E to spend too much time on recording and reptile intrusion. But with the advent of the public health record and the A&D model is due to come online in just a couple of months, we are looking at actually being able to key in more comfortably so that more information will be accessible in the future.
Question number 100, the Honourable Mrs. Ireland and Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister responsible for elderly care advise whether the newly refurbished balconies at Mount Alvernia are safe and are open to use by the service users and their families?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. The refurbishment of Mount Alvernia balconies at Facade received their approval notice and certificate of completion, number 729, from the Department of Planning and Building Control. The health and safety plan was approved by the planning supervisor of technical services. Mobile residents can visit and relatives can enjoy the use of the balcony whenever they wish. The balustrades have been designed to a height to maintain safety measures and all risk assessments that have been carried out by the health and safety officer. Presently, we are in the process of implementing disabled accessible ramps for balcony access for those on wheelchairs. However, the premises were completed in the 1960s with no requirement of disability, so disability was in place, and therefore we have issues that are being assessed in order to find the best option for wheelchair users. All balconies have only for the summer period, which is the best time for residents to enjoy the sunshine and view. Residents are happier, finally, they now have a splendid view of the very resplendent and the beautiful light of the new dawn that this government has brought about. As I have previously had the struggle in blocking their view and making their room dry for more than 12 years.
Mr. Speaker, when have these particular balconies been opened for members of the public and also for service users? Because the Honourable Lady has served the summit, but I have been there visiting a relative of mine. And I was told that the balconies were not acceptable to service users because the government was still assessing whether it was safe for service users to be able to use it. Now, that was in December. And those reports are actually coming to us thick and fast, right? That is the reason why this particular question has been asked. And if you're aware that service users are being prevented from visiting from going onto those balconies because there is this impression on the part of staff that in some states the government is looking at safety issues in the making of the balconies.
Speaker, I see a service user with certain conditions like dementia or whatever would not be allowed on the road and escorted. I haven't had this information passed to me. I have consulted my honourable friend who was previously Minister for the Visiting for the Elderly, and she shares that view. I will, however, be there tomorrow afternoon. I'll go there as often as I can. And I will myself assess it and attempt to step onto the balcony. If there is that kind of issue, I will certainly deal with it right away. But the prepared reply that I have from the official responsible is the one that I have mentioned, clearly with a little bit of play added. And therefore, that is the information that I have.
Question number 101, the Honourable Mrs. Ireland and Ireland.
Can the Minister for Health say when the abdominal aortic aneurysm screening will be starting and who will be eligible for it?
I will say the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Lady will be very happy to learn that the programme will be launched on the 25th of February. This is not answer question before, that's the 25th of February, and it's due to commence in March. Screening will be for men approaching their 65th birthday. The Honourable Lady will no doubt wish to congratulate the government for this great innovation.
Question number 102, the Honourable Mrs. Ireland and Ireland.
Very welcome you to the AAO screening. Mr. Speaker, can the Minister of Health say at what stage the review of the sponsored patient scheme is?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Health, Environment and Energy.
Apologies, Mr. Speaker, the actual green paper wasn't in front of me, so I can't the Deputy Chief Minister for learning his outside so that I can reply from here. Thank you. It is better than the other green paper. Mr. Speaker, yes, sir, I have recently had what will be the final, and it will have been, the final meeting of the working group, and I now have proposals ready for discussion and approval. Sorry, that is. For discussion and approval by Cabinet.
Question number 103, the Honourable Mrs. Ireland and Ireland.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say what stage the negotiations for the consulting contracts are at?
I will say the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Speaker, yes, sir. The negotiations are at an advanced stage with the final draft contract having just been reviewed by the DHA's legal advisors. It will be presented to Unite for final discussion within weeks.
Question number 104, the Honourable G. Davis.
Any member of the tourism, please provide details of the number of Queensland arrivals for the month of January 2015.
I will serve the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Thank you, Speaker. Two police ships arrived in the boat in January 2015.
I'm simply making a direct comparison to the position as it was last year. I haven't had the opportunity of looking at previous years and to see whether this is a trend and which direction it's going. But certainly, the difference between January 2014 and January 2015 is an effectively less. Do you have an explanation as to why that is the case? Just prepared as an expected supplementary from you.
Because I do have the figures for the expected annual figures, which we expect in the course of the year and not just the month. And we have an additional 216 ships expected in 2015, which is, 216 ships are expected in total, which is 35 more than last year. And I'd like to add the second annual figures.
Mr. Speaker, that's your expectation, but did you have an explanation as to why there are three left from last year?
Mr. Speaker, this is a fluid arrangement, so companies are seeing fluctuations in some of these.
the speaker, a better move on the standing order 7-3, the same standing order 7-1, in order to proceed with the government statement. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. Keep in touch. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member will be aware of the following secretary, the Right Honourable Philip Hammond, MP. It's today in Madrid for the purposes of meeting with the Spanish Foreign Secretary, Senor García Margallo y Martín. I have this afternoon heard from the Foreign Secretary after he has finished his meeting with Senor Margallo. As Honourable Members will also be aware, the Foreign Secretary has in the past month been embarked on a tour of European capitals, holding talks with all EU partners in respect of EU reforms. This visit was part of that tour and included discussion of the foreign policy challenges the UK and Spain share, including continued Russian-backed aggression in Ukraine and the threat of global terrorism. The Foreign Secretary has confirmed that during the course of the meetings with his Spanish counterparts, he also took the opportunity, as we had agreed that he would, to raise the concerns of the UK government and those of Her Majesty's government of Gibraltar. In particular, the Foreign Secretary raised the issue of the continued incursions by the Spanish state vessels into British Gibraltar or waters, which detailed Mr. Margallo are illegal under international law and therefore unacceptable. He also raised the continued delays at the frontier between Gibraltar and Spain. The Foreign Secretary has also confirmed that he told his Spanish counterpart, as we had agreed, that Spain needs to address delays at the border, which the European Commission has already found to be disproportionate. Further, and also as agreed between us, Mr. Hammond raised our joint disappointment at Spain's holding up EUA rules in legislation by seeking to excuse Gibraltar in a blatant further breach of the Cordoba Agreement, which the UK and Gibraltar continue to honour and EU law. Mr. Hammond restated our common call for a return to dialogue in order to deal with these and all other issues and matters of mutual interest to people who live and work on both sides of the frontier. The Speaker of the House will be pleased to note that in that context, the Foreign Secretary reminded him and other that the UK remains strongly committed to the trilateral forum for dialogue. He also told him that until we can return to that forum, we in the United Kingdom and Gibraltar will continue to work towards ad hoc talks involving all relevant parties and issues of mutual interest. The Foreign Secretary informed that the Senor Margallo informed me that the NAIA has made a further proposal in this respect today, which the government will now be further considering with UK colleagues. Mr. Speaker, no one should confuse or allow anyone else to confuse any thinking that the raising of the issues about Gibraltar today amounted in any way to a bilateral negotiation about Gibraltar. No such negotiation will be acceptable to the people or government of Gibraltar and this House. Indeed, the UK, through its Foreign Secretary, has confirmed again today in Madrid its strong commitment to the trilateral forum and it and our hopes to return to that forum whenever possible. As ministers have already stated, Spain is a key partner for the UK as it is for Gibraltar. But the UK-Spain bilateral relationship is not as strong as it could be due to recent Spanish actions towards Gibraltar and its people. Mr. Speaker, in that context, the government is pleased that the position set out by the Foreign Secretary in Madrid is exactly in keeping with what was agreed between us and entirely represents the position of the government and people of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, I trust that this statement will assist in informing the House as to the events of today in Madrid. This is what has delayed me from arriving in time for 3 o'clock this afternoon. Yes, Mr. Speaker. Subject to this side of the House, the need for bilateralism, yes, to trilateralism, is our policy and has been our policy for over 15 years. So in that sense, Mr. Speaker, we associate ourselves with the sentiment expressed by the Chief Minister, and we certainly welcome that that is the position that's been made clear by the Foreign Secretary to the Foreign Secretary of Spain in Madrid. But Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Chief Minister spoke about further proposals being made by Senor Margallo, and I wonder whether, in the interest of providing a full statement to this House about the report that's been provided to him of that meeting in Madrid, he can give us some further information about what that further proposal from the Spanish side entails. Mr. Speaker, not at this stage. The government is considering the proposal made. If it is just come in, I don't think it is in the interest of the committee or to the government having an opportunity to consider something we could make a statement about it. It is literally less than half an hour since I had the benefit of communication from the Foreign Secretary in respect of the subject. and it should be that you be prepared to briefly in private as to the proposal that has been made. We're asking the government to comment on the proposal, to say whether the proposal is good or bad, but at the very least for the government to brief your position, what is that proposal that's been received by the that's been made by the Spanish Foreign Secretary to his counterpart, Mr. Hammond. Mr. Speaker, as he knows, I'm quite happy to brief him in private, and this is on the basis of complete confidentiality. We have business to be getting on with now. I'm quite happy to brief him afterwards. That's why this government is the one that's going to pursue the establishment of the two-person consultative commission to enable that sort of communication to occur, but it will be on the basis of strict and utter confidentiality.
We will now proceed with questions to the speaking minister. Question 181. Question number 181, the Honourable C.J. Rufino.
Thank you,
Mr.
Speaker. Can you please make a state whether you have received a reply to the letter to the UK leader of the opposition in relation to comments regarding the implementation of a central register of ultimate beneficial ownership?
On to the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. Mr. Speaker, I will have the opportunity of reading the Honourable Chief Minister's address after I saw it posted on Twitter. I've also had the benefit of reading some details and questions to be issued in relation to this point. So I know what he said, but can you give me an indication of what the Honourable Leader of the UK, the Right Honourable Leader of the Opposition, told him in response? Mr. Speaker, I had various conversations with the Leader of the Opposition since he received my letter, and he, I think, now understands why it was that the Volta felt it was important that he should understand the issues related to the central register, the progress the group in particular makes, together with the United Kingdom and all other central member states of the European Union in respect to financial services matters, where we stand and whether such a register should be public or not. The answer that the reply has not been formally in writing, but by way of telephone conversation. But is that what he's telling me? I haven't heard a couple of minutes to get to that detail. So I do think that there is any formality that is attributed to somebody to be writing, which is not attributed to somebody which has been on telephone or in conversation. It was a formal response to the issue that I put in writing. Mr. Speaker, he, I'm sure, will agree with me say that, when I say that before the matter of crucial importance to the voter, the way that the Right Honourable UK leader of the opposition represented the voter's status in regard to this particular case of misstated the position in relation to the voter's position in relation to this matter. Is there, as a result of those conversations, any possibility of the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, particularly its leader, to retract publicly the statement it has made, at least in so far, as it affects the Volta position in relation to this point? Is there any possibility of that happening? Because when I was 30 seconds old, he was, when I think it was on Sunday, the report of this policy was made in the news media in the UK, and the Volta featured very much in it when they went through all the different overseas policies. I think it did quite a lot of, I think, unfair damage in terms of what he said. Would policy that he thinks should be responsible? A few more of the government has asked me whether I think any part of it should be responsible. Which part of the letter from the leader of the opposition is it that he was asking me whether the chance would be retracted? I mean, if he doesn't want to answer that to enable me to answer his question, that's for him, but I mean. Mr. Speaker, I've asked the question and I'm expecting an answer from the Chief Minister. Certainly, thousand comments were made in relation not just to the overseas charities, but to voters within the overseas charities, which caused him to come up in a refined and voter news outlet to defend the government's position and made him write to that quite a strongly worded letter to the government's position. Mr. Speaker, I have been asked the question, which was, Israel account of the leader of the position in the UK is going to be tracking part of the letter. And I'm saying, which part of the letter is it that the Obama government is asking it, Israel account will reject? Because generally, the statements that he made, the policy statements in relation to the blacklist of Gibraltar in relation to the OECD, and with a precedent in the letter, he certainly said that to one of the OECD charities, published in state evidence by the editor of the Gibraltar Chronicle. I'm not sure the only one who's going to receive a similar letter to that. I assume he did. I'm not sure whether he did. But certainly, he threatened that unless the OECD charities got the action order in relation to the central register, he would ask the OECD to blacklist us. And in relation to that, I will report that if there has been a clarification of this, I think as far as the vote is concerned, of its position, that the right of the government should reject the issue publicly, and it can be a suggestion of the issue. Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid that the other government needs to sort of respect by at least some of the more prepared for these questions. The letter that the Honourable Leader of the Republican United Kingdom sent to all the leaders of the OECD services was published in generic form in The Guardian. It was published in Portugal, which is a Muslim center, although I acknowledge that he might not have picked that up until I was there to report during the course of Sunday. The letter, Mr. Speaker, talks not about the issue so much of central registry, but much more about the issue of whether beneficial ownership, which is the central registry we're about, will be available publicly in later registry to be accessed publicly. What the leader of the position in the UK said was that within 6 months of their being elected, the charity did not agree to have the central registry made public, then he would ask the OECD to blacklist those charities. He's not making any allegations, Mr. Speaker, about the vote that received Christian Shack. So, as long as you look at my letter, what I'm telling the leader of the opposition in the United Kingdom is what is wrong with that policy. But it's not only that he said about Gibraltar, which requires reflection. Of course, I don't have his letter. I look at other people have commented about the overseas territories, whether we're tax havens or not, and whether the issue of central register, etc., is one that is determinative of whether one is central or one is a tax haven or not. But he will have seen that my letter sets out the Gibraltar position. The Gibraltar position is that we will be complying with the fourth anti-money laundering directive within the conditional provision provided in the directive once it is published and publication is expected during the course of September of this year with the conditional provision of this year. Now, is he asking me, have I managed to get the leader of the opposition to change his party's policy in that respect? Is that the question?
Question number 182, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Can the government please say how much it has paid, either directly or indirectly, and either in minor benefits to Joe Castelli since its took office divided into calendar years? I will say the Honourable Chief Minister.
This is now the Honourable Member's schedule with the information in question.
Question number 182, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, I find the Chief Minister to provide a list of all people invited by government to his recent talk in Madrid. I answer the Honourable Chief Minister. the people are unable to provide the details requested at the time, the information requested requires that all accounts be reconciled. To date, we have still not received. Okay. I will say the first answer. I will answer together the question 184. And if you see the funding consists of provided a breakdown of all costs associated with recent shorts in the bridge, including the cost of accommodation, travel, expense, and expenses of anyone traveling with or invited by the government to that event. I'll answer the honourable chief minister. We are unable to provide the details requested at this time. The information requested requires development to be reconciled. The data has still not received all invoices in order for us to complete the exercise. In any event, Mr. Speaker, the information will not be publicly provided. The cost of my travel here will be set out in the government website when available. Can the Chief Minister provide a reason why we can't provide you with a list, first of all, of people that have been invited to this event in Madrid by the government of Gibraltar, and also, secondly, the people that have been paid for by the government to go out to Madrid in order to attend this course? I mean, surely that information ought to be disclosable by the government as something for which the government is accountable. These are effectively taxpayers' money which the government is using in order to invite people to attend this course in Madrid, and is accountable to this house, and I can't see any conceivable reason why this information may not should be provided to this house. Or is it that he doesn't know that at every turn, the Spanish Foreign Ministry has been trying to suggest that the opportunity afforded to the Chief Minister of Gibraltar to address a number of prominent people in Madrid, not a 5 or 6 people, a very large number of prominent people in Madrid, was simply engineered and paid for by the government of Gibraltar to speak to. Now, I'll be very careful with what I told him. I told him what I had told him before. I have said I will not give the information publicly, Mr. Speaker. Now, of course we're accountable in this matter for every penny of taxpayers' money that we spend. I'm quite happy to give him the information and have such discussion with him, Mr. Speaker. But it's quite an honor for me to stand in this house and give him all the information of all the money that we have to spend in Spain, given the hostility that we face from that government there, in order to be able to get across the message of the people of the world. Now, I've told you before in the recent for another matter, and I'll tell you again, I'm happy to give him the information. But if he does not see that it is not in the public interest of the world for that information to be not only across the house, it's not just the 17 of us here, but to be made publicly available, we want to have thrown in our face that we have never heard the Spanish Foreign Minister talk about how to also use its economic power in order to be able to get its message across. It was something that was done by the previous administration when they needed to do it in the early part of the last session when Gibraltar faced the issue of their sovereignty, something that we are having to do today in order to ensure that all of the lies and all of the information that there is about Gibraltar did not find itself uncounted in the Spanish press and in the Spanish media and in the Spanish public opinion, but we are doing it now. Now, Mr. Speaker, you can have the information if you like behind the Speaker's chair. I'm not suggesting you cannot have it. I was very careful about what I said. I will not make the information publicly available. But I'm not, Mr. Speaker, persuaded that that is information which there is any benefit to making public in this house to the world at large.
Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid that he continuously uses and demeans debates and sessions of this house by constantly showing this particular card every time we ask what is a legitimate question. But unless the government effectively has engineered an attendance at the Madrid talk by paying dozens of families accommodation and subsistence in order to get them to attend, it can't possibly be an issue. Mr. Speaker, the provision of this information. Now, in order to make it easier for the owner of the chief minister, well, look, they provide you with information of those in Spain that have been invited at government expense to attend that Madrid call. But at least provide you with information of those with Gibraltar residents that have travelled to Madrid at public expense for the purpose of that talk. That surely can't be of any sensitive nature. And it would at least allow us to see whether taxpayer money is being set in spend. Because if what you have is a situation that out of 100 people attending that Madrid talk, 80 are from Gibraltar, and they've been subsidized by the government to go up to Madrid, when all he's doing is pay for cheerleaders to go with him to Madrid, and we would say, I'm afraid that is not good use of taxpayers' money. So I'm doing, in order to fix it, I'm doing that distinction, and perhaps he can provide me with the information as far as the local consumer is concerned.
Where the government over there is not concerned about the national interest of Gibraltar. He has given a mysterious Spanish headline writer still great opportunities to score or attempt to score a goal against the government of Gibraltar, which he will not have an opportunity to reply to. The first is, si son pruebas impresas sin cargo, invita a decenas de españoles sin que tengan que pagar su gasto para su discurso en España. Simpson suggests that the people who have also engineered dozens of families all expenses paid to report in Spain. But the headline enough is enough, Mr. Speaker, to damage Gibraltar. The headline is enough to play directly into the hands of Gibraltar's enemies, Mr. Speaker. The next one is the signature of a plea for cheerleaders to go with them up to Spain to Madrid. Another twist to a Spanish headline writer, regardless of what the national interest of Gibraltar may be. Stop with his ambition, Mr. Speaker, but he doesn't even see it, and when he finds out questions like this, the potential danger for Gibraltar, all he wants to do is throw away. Now, Mr. Speaker, on expenses, because everything is now about expenses. Mr. Speaker, I heard him say a moment ago, before I came into the House, that Gibraltar speaks. That is the first time in the history of Gibraltar that a leader of the opposition has suggested that Gibraltar is bankrupt. That is what Tim means. What will Mr. Margallo make of that? What will Mr. Margallo make of that? Or any other one more of our enemies? Because even in 1992 and 1996, even at every time when the dispute between this side of the mouth and that side of the mouth of the world, nobody has ever suggested that Gibraltar is bankrupt, like he has this afternoon. The absolute irresponsibility of the man is just incredible, Mr. Speaker. Look, since we are, Mr. Speaker, since in this house of a good opposition, since of an opposition that knows what it's doing, and since of an opposition that discharges his obligations loyally to Gibraltar, absolutely since and bankrupt. Because what he's telling us, Mr. Speaker, is that he wants information which he could have by simply turning on his television and watching the magnificent recording that our media made of that excellent opportunity I had in Madrid to deliver Gibraltar's point of view. He can see who was there from Gibraltar and who was not. And he can see, Mr. Speaker, that there was 80 from Gibraltar who were cheerleaders. There was actually a huge majority of people who were famous, leading politicians, Mr. Speaker. Not one or two, Mr. Speaker. Leading politicians, people who are today in the parliament, people who are opinion formers, people who speak for their party. Not regional or municipal individuals who don't speak for their party. Leading individuals in their party who have mistaken at last the policy of the party in opposition to continue committed to the trilateral forum. That is the level of achievement that the chief minister in Madrid 2 weeks ago finally delivered for Gibraltar. It's not a question of taking cheerleaders anywhere. I don't need to take cheerleaders anywhere to do that. Thank goodness I got the focus in the places that he might believe. Except for Mr. Speaker, to hear that the first argument is that Joe Bassani, who has been
giving his life to devote, the person that he has given the past 30 years of his life to devote, who they used to say were so in love with devotion that they couldn't be objective when it came to sitting down perhaps with families and considering talking about our future with them. That we all collectively want to bankrupt devotion. But I think not even want to, Mr. Speaker. Today we have to say we force bankruptcy to devotion because we ask him. That we're going to blow up the whole of the Western state of this rock. And not just for Kano and Nakia, but also for Bells, Mr. Speaker. The environmentalists who care about smoke, but it's not going to care about a huge explosion that's going to deliver us into the Neolithic age. And that now, finally, here is we are, thanking for the platform from Orange Speaker, we're still leaving, Mr. Speaker.
What a pity that we are so sick of our tradition in the past.
The Honourable Speaker had shown signs of pressure for getting to him even before this question and answer session. But that answer demonstrates to me just the extent to which the pressure is getting to him. It really is seeming far too much. He is carrying the office that he had with his head on his shoulders. It really is very damaging and can't take the pressure. Now, Mr. Speaker, he came on the ambition card. First it was the misogynistic card. Now it's Daniel Speaker being too ambitious. I'm saying to the Spanish, Mr. Speaker, very few weeks after we had the Dr. Rinaldi home, where ministers opposite participated in a program.
Mr. Speaker, absolutely, I think the people of Gibraltar get the gist of where I was going in the light of the comments made by the Chief Minister that we on this side of the House, are playing to Spanish galleries. I haven't participated in any Spanish TV program being the people of Gibraltar guy, Mr. Speaker. That's the point that I was going to be making. But Mr. Speaker, did you not realize, the Honourable Chief Minister, that it's actually seen with the way that he's answered this particular question, a very innocuous question, designed to deal with, designed to show how much the government has actually spent on this particular event, but the way that he has answered it, he is giving ammunition that he won't realize who our citizens say by making a molehill out of a mountain out of a molehill. Because it looks as if the government has got something to hide. Now I repeat, Mr. Speaker, will you not at the very least provide me with the information of who exactly on the Gibraltar side went to this particular event and at what cost? There cannot possibly be any national interest in the provision of that information. And that is a legitimate question, bearing in mind that he is accountable for the taxpayer's money to this House, and that goes to expenditure that the government is incurring. I leave for the moment, and if you give me information, behind the Speaker's chair is against you. The Spanish contingent and how much he has paid in relation to that. But surely, there cannot be any excuse for the Honourable Gentleman not providing me with information in respect of who from Gibraltar has been, went to this event at the invitation of the government and paid for by the government. That's what I'm interested in. Mr. Speaker, who can give him the information behind the Speaker's form? And I'm not going to give him the information here publicly. Now, Mr. Speaker, whether the Speaker has been overheard to use rather unparliamentary language to describe the man I'm full of, well, I mean, it's just that the feeling is so neutral, Mr. Speaker, that perhaps we so need to, who they need to understand what the words use there. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman needs to understand where the use of the word. He needs to read a bit more. He needs to be a little bit more concerned about the whole thing, a little bit less concerned about himself.
I heard you say the other afternoon, Mr. Speaker, in London here, I didn't know what it was, the podcast that they themselves characterized as comedy, when they put it on YouTube, or whether it was one of his interviews on BBC, Mr. Speaker. But, when he talks about things, people don't realize the importance of issues. But then eventually, everybody realizes how he has been right from the beginning. And he uses an example from the finances. Mr. Speaker, as he said on the news board, I'm talking about the power station now, and I think that this is not so important. But eventually, everyone will agree with me, as everyone now agrees to move into a public finances. Well, you know, I don't know who gets that yet. Maybe he's relying on the last poll. I mean, we don't comment on polls, but maybe he's relying on the last poll that gave him an extraordinary lead of 20% over our 74%. Maybe he took out the undecided. But anyway, that could be taking comfort from. Maybe that's what he's working about if everybody who agrees with him in relation to public finances. But he needs to read a bit more around these issues, because he's on that subject. What he was saying in relation to the answer I'm giving him about why things matter in Spain and why we should not share them, I want you to be a bit more circumspect when he says things, even things as a basis of the fact that we might want to be reticent to whether we blow up the Western side of Gibraltar. It's that there is a huge confluence. I mean, she's talking to the president, I wonder whether they speak it or not, Mr. Speaker, between what the honorable gentleman says and the things that Señor Andaluza says. What the honorable gentleman says and the things that Señor Magallanes says when they're criticizing the Chief Minister of Gibraltar and the government of Gibraltar. Señor Andaluza said recently that the power station, because it was gas and it was going to be put on the area of the Reformation in the North Nile, was a danger to the whole of the Campo de Gibraltar. The government of Gibraltar is using its economic power in order to be able to address the media and public opinion foremost in Spain. And then you can be a position in Gibraltar asking, oh yes, how much of that economic power have you invested in this particular issue? The political gentleman may want to be the minister more than he cares about Gibraltar. That's obvious to most who are following his political career. But he needs to be a little bit more careful about the way he goes about things. Even, Mr. Speaker, let me give him this certificate. Even, Mr. Speaker, if he was a single hostage, maybe if I'm saying the same thing to John Luisa Mariano all the time, it may not suit me so much, because I should find a different fact. So with giving information behind the speaker's chair, I will not give it to him otherwise. If you look at the video of who was in Madrid, then he'll be able to see for himself. It is, Mr. Speaker, available. I thought it was fantastically available to the people of Gibraltar when the broadcasting population put it on viewpoint. I think it's available on their website. All he needs to do is sit down and watch it now. If it is that he cannot bear to hear my voice on television and he doesn't want to sit and watch the video and doesn't want to watch the timing of time to show him who was there and who wasn't, well, look, so be it. I will tell him for nothing, Mr. Speaker, that the Nearby Condominium Forum provides the only speaker present and the hot chocolate and the coffee for everyone who comes out. So everyone who sees on camera, who can work out, have the coffee dollars, the hot chocolate and the coffee paid for by the government of Gibraltar. What more do we need? Why is it so important? But that, Mr. Speaker, it is that he has persuaded himself that we are, in fact, skinny, and that we can't even afford the honesty. What the pity, Mr. Speaker, there might actually be a legal definition who fails to understand the economics, the public finances, and the reality of the border to such an extent that he might actually believe that.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we will see who understands the economics of the public finances of Gibraltar when he and I participate in the debate on GDP and constrained by the rules of the past. And then we will see who understands the public finances of Gibraltar and who doesn't. Because I have to say, I concluded a long time ago that he certainly doesn't. And that is precisely the reason why the worthwhile leader, the Honourable Minister Bocana, answers every single session of the House, answers questions on the economy of Gibraltar and the public finances of Gibraltar instead of him. He doesn't, it's just an assignment, because he understands them and the Honourable Gentleman
the Chief Minister does not. And talking about ambitions, Mr. Speaker, well, look, it was, I'm talking about bankruptcy and scheme. Was it not the Honourable Gentleman that, for months before the last general election, was telling the people of Gibraltar that the DFD was a victory to death, that we were very close to bankruptcy, and that they needed a saviour in the form of a new Dawn government? Well, look, he's accusing me of precisely what he did prior to the 2011 election. I don't understand how he can criticize me in those terms when he did it to a greater extent when he was trying to become a Chief Minister of Gibraltar. But Mr. Speaker, how indeed he was successful. Absolutely. His arguments were successful. We will see whether my arguments are successful or not. But that's democracy. But Mr. Speaker, he talked about how much economic power is used by the government to invite people from Spain to his court. He's also said in the course of his answers that in fact this is a very, very successful meeting for him. And you know, I'm glad that it was a very successful meeting for Gibraltar. I really am glad. But look, at the end of the day, I am entitled to know and I'm entitled to assess that information that he is providing, the information that he is by asking questions in this place. And I just do not understand why he is not prepared to provide me with information as to how much he is paid, for example, particular trade unionists to go to Madrid in order to listen to his speech. At first blush, I don't understand what the benefit of that to Gibraltar is. I can understand the benefit of going to Spain and addressing a Spanish audience. And I can understand at a push that he will not want to give me information as to, I don't agree with it, but I can understand it, as to exactly who on the Spanish side has been invited by the government of Madrid, at government expense, I'm talking about, at government expense, because there might be criticized there. Look, I can understand that argument. But who on earth from Spain is going to criticize Victor Cerro? Or who on earth from Spain is going to criticize Mr. Bukidji of the self-determination group for going with the devoted delegation to Madrid? And what I want to know is what the government has spent in inviting those people. And surely that is not something that the Chief Minister ought to refuse to provide across the floor of the party. Well, Mr. Speaker, I mean, what next? So he can't win the debate as he expected, because he's looking forward to it being a debate unconstrained by the rules of the House. He can't win the debate constrained by the rules of the House. Because of course, the only way that he can win a debate is by saying, you're lying, or you give another insult. He cannot use that insult here. So therefore, he wants to have the argument unconstrained by the rules of the House. I don't find the rules of the House constraining when it comes to have any debate on any particular issue. But I very much look forward to having the debate on public finances, on GDP. Not because we will be unconstrained by the rules of the House, but because we might be unconstrained by the timing of the House, the fact that people might not be available to watch us at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and everybody will be watching us at 9:30, well, everybody, maybe people who might have better interest, everybody's on the way, but at 9:30, they will actually listen to the debate, and you might not get away with pretending that the government doesn't give information, that the government is pretending to speak things to them when it comes to public finances and so forth. So people will see the government giving the information and debating it with me and following the government in that debate. But eventually, that is really unconstrained by the rules of the House. Because we've been on television, is it a good service that he wants to win it unconstrained by the rules of human decency and wants to go outside GDP and have a comeback? Like he challenged the Honourable, the father of the House to do at the beginning of this parliament, or the lifetime of this parliament. Why does he have to be? Let me finish the phrase. Mr. Speaker, he has to make himself responsible for the accuracy of the information he provides to the staff. I never challenge the Honourable Mr. Lassana. Mr. Lassana challenged me to the Anti-Chamber. So it was the reverse.
Speaker,
to that they could take that. I believe that the Honourable Gentleman Simon, the Honourable Father of House, say, Mane a Mane. And this is very simple. It is the same to one father who can look at what he said at the time, whether he likes it or not. I know that he hates Mr. Speaker. I know that he hates cancer, Mr. Speaker. That little liar that reminds him of the truth. That little chivatito that reminds him of the things he needs to say. That little chivato that doesn't lie, Mr. Speaker. Of course I know he hates to be told about cancer, but it's all in my head, Mr. Speaker. So, I don't fear a debate constrained or unconstrained by the rules of the House, because in a proper debate, the rules actually help to get to the nut of the issue. But Mr. Speaker, why is it that the Honourable the Father of the House answers questions in two books about the defensive issues for the Gibraltar Trade and Cyprus Church, etc.? Well, there was a small matter of a government reshuffle, Mr. Speaker, in the early weeks of December last year, where the Honourable Father of the House took specific ministerial responsibility for the Gibraltar Trade and Cyprus. That is why he now answers those questions. You might be thinking that the Honourable Minister of the Opposition was not alive to that, and we might still be calling us by our old ministerial names. Mine still happens to be Minister. The Honourable Minister now includes in his title the word Gibraltar Savings Bank. That's why he answers those questions. Nothing to do with competence. But of course, the Honourable Gentleman has to always comment on people's competence. If it's a topic like this, he has to comment about competence. Not unlike what his predecessor used to be. It's the one thing in which he is actually quite remarkably similar to Sir Peter when Sir Peter was Chief Minister. Because as Chief Minister, Sir Peter spent a lot of time telling me that I was unfit to govern. Well, Mr. Speaker, people took a different view. He just commented on my competence. This is not a place in which we've always done to comment on each other's competence. It's a chance to look for information and to comment on information and give our opinions on information. But look, given it, it's good for the group, it's good for the band, and he likes to comment on my competence, I'd tell him that thing, and he'll be very happy to hear me. He'll be very happy to hear me on this, because I'm going to actually credit him. I'm used to things, Mr. Speaker, that he was quite an unbalanced individual, but I'm clearly wrong, because he's going to sit on both stages, not just one. Whether it comes to ambition, or it comes to his ability to understand public finance, he said, it's not enough to that he can't be unbalanced. He's managed to get that exactly right, 50-50. Mr. Speaker, I think it was strange the run up to the last general election saying that Gibraltar was bankrupt. And as ever, Mr. Speaker, the devil is in the details. Something that perhaps the Liberal gentleman doesn't have the time these days to try and look at. All I did in the run up to the general election, Mr. Speaker, was put the language that had been used by the DFG in 1996 and say to the then Chief Minister, Sir Peter Caruana, this is what you said in 1996. If we applied the same standards, although we did not share your view in 1996, look at how things have developed. Now, if only he'd looked at that level of detail, he might not have made the monumental mistake he has made today. And it will come back even as a monumental mistake in 1996. To be the only leader of the opposition, in fact, probably the only Gibraltarian politician in our history to say that our community, that our country, that our nation, that our public health, that our sector is bankrupt. Nobody has ever said that before, and so he got up here just before I arrived and said, we are cheap, and that is why we cannot change for the power station. But never mind, there is, not on the silver paper, but shortly to come on another paper, a bill known as an association bill, on which we can have a debate, which will demonstrate that he is absolutely wrong. Mr. Speaker, he talks about the trade unions and what they say. I'm surprised that a man of his socialist conviction should be putting Victor Fuller out for criticism, for a profound and all excuse and a hot topic. I mean, why is it that he doesn't talk about the chairman of the Chamber of Commerce or the Federation of Foreign Industry? Why is it that he is the perennial socialist, he who is redder than red, but not so red that the Chamber might not want to vote for him? The socialist who the Conservatives could choose, and I'm not sure where, he's probably very purple, forgive me, say red and blue. Why is it that he chooses to pick out Victor Sello and not anybody else? Well, Mr. Sigurd,
now, here I am, my view of why it was this morning that he was talking about the fictional figure of 513 more people in the public sector. Because today, although he's wearing red, he's trying to appeal to the blues. So he's trying to get the chamber on side and the federation on side and trying to control public expenditure. Very concerned about the rising numbers in the public sector. He left it. That's obvious in the way that he was in the whole debate. I mean, why would he care that I'm paying for the honesty of the trade unionists and not care that I'm paying for the honesty of a taxing of industry, like the chairman of the Chamber of Commerce? So, to come to the number of these things, Mr. Speaker, is it that he doesn't know that in every other state, money is used for purposes of promoting that state in circumstances such as these, where there isn't a debate across a parliamentary floor about how that money is used? So that's the debate between state floors, like the one I have offered him, which provides oversight on the spending of that money by those elected by the people, governments and the opposition, but it's not public. In Spain, Mr. Speaker, that debate happens very often. And there is a little loyalty about the way that people approach those debates. In other words, they keep very confidential, despite their huge differences, what that money has been spent on and why it has been spent. In some instances, it's known as the Fondo Federalis, for example, in Spain, or Intelligence Committee, Mr. Speaker. Or is it that he can point me to any part of the handset of the Spanish process which sets out what the cost of gathering intelligence on Gibraltar is just in the Spanish state? Does he know what the cost of listening, observing, him, me, I suppose, he's their blue eyed head, and you, their nemesis, is just in the Spanish state? The Spanish state is there. There is oversight by the elected people of the Kingdom of Spain, of the Holy Spirit, what I have offered him. And there is oversight of all the spending that is used against us. But not all of it, not some of it yet, but not all of it is debated across the floor of any parliament. That is what I'm offering. That is mature. Well, Mr. Speaker, if he doesn't want that information, or any other information for that purpose, if all he wants, Mr. Speaker, is to be able to criticize the cost of having invited a trade unionist to Madrid, there's a way out. It's the way out that we always said that I'm offering it. Look, I've already told him the video exists. I've already told him he can sit down and he can look at who was there. He's already obviously pocketed someone who wants to find out. It happens to be Mr. Phillips. So do you? I don't know what problem he has with Mr. Phillips, but he's pissed him out. So, the others who you can see on the video. And then you can do, Mr. Speaker, the exercise that he did this morning. He can work it out for himself and come back here with a figure. So this morning he said, you have enjoyed 513 new members of the public sector. That's the lowest wage in the public sector, an average of overall is 8 million more to the bottom line each year in the current expenditure, which you have added. Absolutely and utter nonsense. But never mind. Let him sit down. Get him? Mr. Speaker, there's a button that says mute on the remote control. He can touch the mute button, he can watch the whole episode of an hour of meeting and see the events in Madrid without having to hear me. I know that obviously my voice looks and he doesn't want to hear it. So I don't like hearing my voice either.
I don't know whether the honourable receives any questions. Important as this might require, but there is a limit. And now, they're both debating and they have been having a conversation. By all means, bring them on to them. I will sit here for as many hours as you like. And look under the guise of two questions. That is a question of the want to continue? Well, look, I may have to think of my thing.
Mr. Speaker, you're absolutely right. As far as I'm here to answer questions, but when one is facing it, one is facing one, as they all have it for the drive. This morning, I can't remember how long you took on the few questions that were on the cycle path, but I think we all feel exactly the same way, and we have better than to do.
15 or 20 questions on cycling, and I thought that I was going to leave the house on a bicycle that way. And they took about 50 to 60 minutes. It's nearly an hour. We were all talking for about an hour.
I'm quite happy to get up to the team now and move on.
I have been very patient in listening to the Honourable Chief Minister with an answer to the question. Twenty minutes. Well, now I'm going to go to Gibraltar, which is unlikely. And I know that since I last came to the House, outside this House, honourable members have been offered an explosive situation. I mean, I know. So it's been debated out there for ages, and now it comes to us today. 2 questions, 55 minutes.
I've listened to the Honourable Chief Minister for the last 20 minutes to go on and ramble and waffle about this and about that and about the other. And I do have one final supplementary, and then I listen to his rambling and waffling answer for as long as he wants. But I think that I ought to ask him to correct the record in a number of respects. Look, I think, Mr. Speaker, that the professor is really now fogging his memory. I really do think that. Because the Honourable Chief Minister, he said that the only reason why the Honourable Mr. Bassano is answering questions in the public finance of Gibraltar is because the deal is settled, but the Honourable Mr. Bassano has been answering my questions on the economy, the public finance of Gibraltar, for the last 2 years, Mr. Speaker. And I would ask the Chief Minister for the sake of accuracy, because he has to make himself responsible for the answers of the statements that he makes in his house, that the very least correct the record in that regard. The question that always been answered by Mr. Bassano, because it's Mr. Bassano that really understands the public finances of the water, can speak authoritatively about them to the extent that he can authoritatively state, Mr. Speaker, the government ministers, including the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, is being brainwashed by consultants to spend too much money. Now, Mr. Speaker, if that is not an indictment, Mr. Speaker, much more powerful than any indictment that I could, an incriminating that I could make of the government benefits, if that is not an indictment, Mr. Speaker, what is? I just, again, for the sake of accuracy, because I know he's not going to provide me with the information that I see, which is obvious information, but I think one that I am entitled, which is a list of the locals that attended the Madrid event and the cost of actually the cost there of taking those locals to Madrid, which has nothing to do with Victor Seller. It's no thinking of Victor Seller at all or anybody else. My comment, none at all, my comment, Mr. Speaker, was that there cannot be any national interest in not telling me how much he has paid for Victor Seller or anybody else in the devoted delegation from going to Madrid. But if I can demonstrate to him that I never challenged Mr. Bassano to a 50 cut or anything of the sort, will he stand in this house, because again, he is responsible for the accuracy of information that he provides, and apologize to this house for misleading this house by saying that I challenged Mr. Bassano, which is certainly not true. What happened there was that Mr. Bassano challenged me, and I stood up and I said, I have never been challenged for 50 cut to a mano a mano by anybody in my life in Parliament, and I didn't expect it. That's the comment.
he wants to make himself responsible for the comments that he makes. I know that he's under a lot of pressure. I know that that pressure is getting to the Honourable the Chief Minister, but I think that despite pressure, the interest of fairness, he ought to be able to correct the record so that it is accurate.
Mr. Speaker, on a point of order, I do not accept the right hand of the Honourable Member to Imam Amano. If he had terminology that I would use, he's got about the same thing as about this. And if I had decided to take him on outside, I wouldn't have taken him out of it. It would have happened.
Well, Peter.
I think I will the Speaker, I am a fan of parliamentary democracy. And I believe that Prime Minister President Diamond is a freedom, although it benefits is an important part of democracy. And therefore, Speaker, the fact that the Honourable Government was sat on such things which are really quite fanciful and had nothing to do with the original question is not something that shocks me, but frankly, it is really quite outside of the rules. But anyway, Mr. Speaker, you know, why is it that the Honourable Government seems to be thinking about and just an answer about the question that is supposed to be important to me when he starts talking about my condition? You see, he doesn't get up and say why he did. He gets up and he says, you have a condition. You have your suffering because of the censure. Anybody who knows me, who knows me, I've been enjoying doing this work, knows that I probably am one of the people who believes the fact of pressure in the context of stress that they might come across. But whether or not I am teaching pressure is totally irrelevant to our democracy and to our community. It might be relevant to my citizen and my family, but it's completely irrelevant to our politics and to what citizen people are going to make when they decide who's going to be allowed to continue running our community for the next 4 years once an election is held. One, but of course, Mr. Speaker, I do not intend to cut a nonce, as the Honourable Gentleman predicted in one of his recent speeches. But once again, most of his predictions are wrong. Like the prediction he made during the course of the fire election that we remember huge turnout needed to win by 10%, which turned out to be a very low turnout, but in the election we won by 10%. But never mind that, Mr. Speaker. Always, he says, Mr. Buchanan has answered these questions. That is not the case. Once again, Mr. Speaker, and the judge will demonstrate that that is not the case. But this is now just arguing about an argument. It is no longer about the math of the issue. But no other issue is something which is important and respected, and I want to deal with. He says, but Mr. Buchanan understands public finance and can talk authoritatively about it. Absolutely true, Mr. Speaker. And the 10 people, rather than 9 people, even in this side of the House with Mr. Buchanan, have always accepted that and believed in Mr. Buchanan's ability to understand public finance. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I think he used to be one of the people to do that before he turned Labour, then turned GOV. But so be it. We still believe in that, Mr. Speaker. We have never changed our opinion on that. I did not, Mr. Speaker, when I became leader of the Devoted Socialist Labour Party, take a new degree in economics. I took, or rather the chairman of the party took, a vote based on the simple majority of those present in the room as to who should be the leader of the party. And starting from my left, Mr. Speaker, let me just describe us in academic or in qualification terms. Lawyer, dietitian, economist, lawyer, historian, lawyer, environmentalist, botanist, doctor of all things today, and lawyer and teacher. Teacher, trade unionist, journalist teacher, lawyer, friend, and lawyer. Only one economist. Only one person who can speak authoritatively on the public finances of Gibraltar as an economist. Because he, Mr. Speaker, certainly, on the day that deal was done, where there was neither a show of hands or a secret ballot, there should have been but very soldiers
other executive maneuver when he became leader of the opposition, couldn't take a necessary group in economic chamber. So he's still as much a lawyer as I am. But of course, he says that he always likes to say during the course of these debates, but I say that I'm cleverer than you and I can speak better on these subjects than you will find it. If you don't have a grandmother, you don't have a grandmother, what can you do? Now, when he says, speaking authoritatively on that subject as he did, Mr. Bassano said that the ministers are capable of being brainwashed. That is not what Mr. Bassano said, Mr. Speaker. He is suggesting what Mr. Bassano said. Mr. Bassano said that consultants might try to brainwash ministers. You can't even do a false lot in the way that you can make it. Consultants must try to brainwash ministers. What does it mean? In this context, what the Commissioner is saying is, they must try, we won't allow it, if nothing will happen, we will be better guardians of the public finance than ever anyone has been before. Why did he say that? And why did he say, quite frankly, we will not give political cover to those who try and get away with spending more of the public finances than the Parliament? Look at that. The Parliament has voted because at the last minute when they were about not to vote in favour of the budget, the people in our second room and said, don't put this political suicide, no opposition has ever not voted in favour of the budget. The Parliament votes in favour of the budget. Why do we say that, and why are we better guardians of that press than anybody ever has been? Because Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member himself cannot have been brainwashed when he was Minister for Justice and responsible for the spending on the new sports and the new prison, the spending of which went through the roof, contrary to the estimate. Even the people cannot have been
allowed to give Minister to come to a conclusion.
Yes, thank you. Even the people cannot have been brainwashed, and I'm dealing with this putting team in the statement from Mr. Bassano. When he was dealing with the airport, which was voted at 24 million and came in at 84, they must have been absolutely permanently bleeding lobotomized. Because the spending was in the order of 3 times what the estimate was on the airport. So there's no question of attempted brainwashing, which we are stopping, and quite right too. There are incidences of absolute total lobotomy of the members of it, which is why we find the public finance rates that we finally re-elected, and by the end of that financial year, the last financial year we were in office, £2 million less in the city. As close to stint as this community is ever going to come. Under them, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, my final supplement. But Mr. Speaker, it's a supplementary. I can't allow the Honourable the Chief Minister to get away with whitewashing the comments of the Honourable Minister Bassano. Because I'm going to quote exactly what Minister Bassano said. He said this, quote, the guys that have been brought in as consultants and are still there are responsible for a lot of projects, and they seem to think that they have a free hand to spend money. And maybe they go to their minister and they sort of brainwash him into thinking it without being conscious. They brainwash him, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, you cannot airbrush away interviews that have been given by his ministers to BBC, which are then reported in the press. That is a quote, and it's a quote from the Gibraltar Chronicle of what Mr. Bassano said. And that is the worst indictment, the worst possible indictment of this government runaway expenditure, that anybody could have possibly come up with. And it doesn't come from the opposition benches. It comes from one of his own on his own benches. That is a terrible indictment, Mr. Speaker.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the position
this is last time from the Chief Minister. I am really not used to such changes to our conclusion.
So, to do that, the Honourable Gentleman just gets that full enthusiasm, thinking he's on the point. reads the quote and realizes as he stops over it, it says maybe. And Thomas, it says maybe. It says maybe. But I better not repeat that bit when I go back and say the bit that I want for Thomas to be inviting them all for. So maybe this happens. And so we're going to stop it there. And he doesn't like that. And he doesn't like that because he can only repeat the bit he likes. You know, maybe I'm constrained by the rules of the great and the fact if he were actually slightly more constrained by the rules of the court, he might find the judge asking him to repeat. So the judge might say, well, I think you should have Mr. Fisher, you should repeat that. But he actually say maybe. Did he actually say maybe? And there's no need, Mr. Fisher, for him to repeat it again for a very simple reason. Because, as I told him a moment ago, there is a chapter of English which is unfair, which will have chapter and verse recorded what he already read a moment ago. So it was all in the context of maybe. So therefore, no indictment. So Mr. Peter, but if you want to talk about indictment, and talk about runaway expenditure, well, Mr. Peter, that is not the happening. But this is not a debate on public finance. The appropriation debate is coming. And we will see who is right on all of these issues. Just like we will see in the fullness of time, when we sit back and look at all of his predictions, where exactly is that they all end up. The last one was that I would say that Putin ran and had an early election. I guess it's because it's all about running. I don't know whether the running is a race, but someone decided to become a jogger these days. It's all about runaway expenditure and now cutting and running to go to an election. All of what you've predicted will be proved to be entirely wrong. He said during the course of his earlier presidential that the information he was seeking was selective and critically important. Well, for the speaker, he said 55 minutes or maybe even longer. But innocuous information, if it's so innocuous, why bother to insist on it? Why not say to me, well, you're thinking, let me have it behind the seat of chair and I'll take a view. Is it so innocuous? Is it so innocuous? And whether he likes it or not, I am the chief minister of Gibraltar. Is that whether Mr. Malaya likes it or not? Gibraltar is not Spanish. There is a speaker that makes it British. So actually, it is not Spanish. And the jury is not Spanish. And today, I am the chief minister of Gibraltar. I don't make it hurt. I don't make it great. That's the reality. We have to deal with it every morning, I know. But it's the reality. And I am therefore saying to him, I believe it is not in the public interest of Gibraltar to do this. Look at what the newspapers say, look at what Mr. Malaya is saying in the newspapers, let me give you the information behind the speaker's chair. If it is so innocuous, the information that he is seeking, why did he not accept it in that way? Or is it enough, Mr. Speaker, that the information is not so innocuous, as he knows?
Question 195. Question number 195, the Honourable G.A. Peter. Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please state whether he considers the plans he announced for GDP in 2012 are still on course to be achieved? Answer the Honourable Chief Minister. Well, Mr. Speaker, you may recall that in relation to those plans, when he made the announcement, he said that that GDP would be self-funding and profitable through use of the company which GDP was to have a 50% shareholding. That was Gibraltar, the collective Gibraltar network or Gibraltar Entertainment Network Limited, where another UK company, an entertainment company, had the other 50%, and that they would have premises at Europa Point. And that those premises would be completed by 2015. So this is prediction that his plans are on course include the fact that those premises are going to be built, except for GDP and also for this particular company. Those premises have already been provided at one stage when the was operating from premises in Europa Point. I think it was one of the emerging properties that were there. But I am very confident that our overall plan for GDP is moving in the direction in which we want to move it. It may have different permutations, but my plan for GDP is on course to be achieved.
Mr. Speaker, just to be clear, the plan included the GDP to be self-funding
and the way that the government was going to make the BBC self-funding was through this subsidiary company, which was going to be attracting productions to Gibraltar using Gibraltar's beneficial tax system in order for those productions to be done here in Gibraltar to generate profits so that BBC could then become self-funding, presumably through the profits paid out from the subsidiary company to BBC. Is he saying that those plans of self-funding to BBC via this particular company are still on course to be achieved?
I think I'm saying that my plans for BBC to eventually become self-funding are on course to be achieved. There continues to be the view of the chief executive of BBC and my view, and we think we have a very good chance of actually making funding of BBC rather than considering just something that costs the community money to provide service. It could actually be an engine of growth for the community.
And that is going to take place, or the plan is that the way that BBC would become profitable would be through this particular subsidiary company generating those kind of profits through local production. That is still the plan.
The plan is that it should become self-financing. The route to that, whether it's through this particular subsidiary or others, or in fact, through even new and more exciting opportunities, which are really essentially being worked on by the chief executive and by the management of GDP and by us. I mean, what could be better than to achieve that? And why couldn't we want to keep on tracking that respect? And I would have thought that we would have enjoyed support from the opposition in this respect. I think, of course, they didn't think of it when they were in power, maybe that's why they don't want to be supported.
Peter, it's not about the opposition not being supported. I am asking him questions. I know that it's irritating when I ask him questions. So that is my job. My job is to hold the government to account on its policy, to inquire as to whether its policy is being successful or is not being successful, so that something can be done about it. It seems fair to deal with the Chief Minister that I am on this side of the House asking questions in the court. Now, Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar Entertainment Network, I think that's the name of the company. Has this company been profitable? Has it been making profits? And has it been making the kind of profit that will allow BBC to be to be well on the road to self-sufficiency? Or is Gibraltar Entertainment Network, has it not been successful, and the government is really looking at other avenues of making BBC self-sufficient?
I'm very comfortable actually saying these things because they are not confident for a democracy like politics. But I cannot allow things that the Honourable Gentleman says go unanswered. So I'm going to deal with that point. If you were preempted from saying these things, I would not have to reply to them. I do not find these questions irritating or hurtful. I actually find them quite amusing. Especially in the context of what it is that he's hopefully trying to achieve, I find most amusing much of what he does and how he goes about it. So he needs to concern himself about irritating me or hurting me. I cannot tell him what the balance sheet of GEM is without notice, but I can tell him that GEM involves certain individuals who continue to work in part with BBC, but not all of them with BBC, and therefore that the original concept of GEM is not actually one that is likely to be progressing into the future, but the ideas behind GEM and how that would lead to GBC being eventually self-financing, self continues to be something that we are pursuing very enthusiastically.
Question number 105, the Honourable G. Dana Fielder.
Can the Minister of Tourism please provide details of the number of upper up nations that are registered for the month of January 2015?
I would say the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Quality and Social Services, and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, 18,774 visitors entered the Upper Rock Nation Reserve during the month of January 2015.
Just to point out, Mr. Speaker, the fact that on the day that I filed the question, which was the Wednesday, it was actually updated online, so don't go for the reply in any event. Mr.
Because that figure is actually slightly higher than the figure in 2014, indeed in 2013. Although it still represents quite a significant reduction from the position in 2011 to 2012. Just in my probably not a question which can be answered, but does that have an indication from the Labour Department as to whether this is likely to go in an increasing upward trend over the next few months? I know it's difficult to predict, but perhaps we can be something in the kind of time of questions to come.
Question number 106, the Honourable Peter Henry.
Further to the answer provided to question number 40 of 2015, can the Minister for Housing inform this House by when it is estimated that the recently installed CCTV soldiers and barrage barriers at Lake Harbour State will be operational on a permanent basis?
I would say the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing. Question number 107, the Honourable Steve J. Hayward.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details in respect to any maintenance program which has been established in respect of the recently installed CCTV project in the balance barriers at Lake Harbour State, indicating who is carrying out the staff and their respective costs?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, as previously informed, the CCTV project is complete. The maintenance of the CCTV project in the Harbour State is carried out by various electrical contractors on a reactive basis. The maintenance is within the 2-year warranty stipulated in the contract documentation, and there is no current financial implication of this is covered under the original contract fund. In relation to the guide failure of the housing department and looking to all permits at the harbour, the guiding and the procedure to be issued with the relevant permits and FOBs, and the barriers will be operational as soon as it is complete. In provide the maintenance, there are plans to engage the services and electrical contractor to adopt the maintenance plan.
So, you see, that I didn't quite catch it very much, but something like the, in respect to the FOBs, of course, talking to the tenants, but could the one on the lady get in my hearing for the CCTV for that point?
What I said, Mr. Speaker, was that we've listened to the tenants, advising them of the procedure to collect the funds. Once everyone is given on a deadline, it should be shown once everyone has a deadline at first, then the barrier will be operational. It should be done next week for the weekend.
I was going to jump in, but I wanted to jump in. So, welcome, Mr. Speaker. Probably if you have a lady company, probably in the next month or so, we should have everything now fully operational.
Mr. Speaker, tenants are written to last week, and the deadline for application for that is the 10th of February, so it should be operational by the end of the month.
Question number 108, the Honourable Angel Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide full details of the extent of damages, inclusive of locations, caused to rent your homes as a result of incident weather during the ongoing refurbishment work at any housing estate since the Minister provided to question number 746 of 2014?
I'll answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, up to the 9th of February, 14 flats have been affected throughout that 5,547 flats in the city of the state, of which 9 have been affected through the roof, 4 by the stairwell and 1 by the window. Further protective measures and minor repairs are currently being undertaken.
I don't understand the question of the message on the deadline of his last prayer this morning, but the other minister said up to the 9th of February, that is, over the week prior to that same information, Mr. Speaker, could have been provided up to that Thursday. I'll tell you why, because one of the things that I was hearing and saying seems to have happened just in the days or in that same week prior to the deadline of the question, and that the minister would have been able to provide information up to the 9th of February. The reason why is now delayed until the latter part of March, in order to be able to get information on something that really happened within the first few days or the first week of February. So the minister required to come and perhaps he can at least get information up to at least the question that I'm trying to put to the moment. I'm going to see if you can be helpful in that.
Since I did ask the department to provide me with as much information as possible, I have to the latest deadline that they were to provide, of course, as you can appreciate that we have the whole internal mechanism and everything for production of answers. In any event, Mr. Speaker, the question can be put to me again next month, so the department can have sufficient time to answer this. In any event, Mr. Speaker, the answer won't change, whether it's the only amount. A delay to the matter comes from the existing parliament every month. The honourable gentleman only has to wait a question of a couple of weeks for that answer. And can only provide as much information as the department provides them. They will give us for as much information as possible to the parliament.
Is there information? So, immediately, the people we can try to do so that, my wording the question identity should the rules of repeating the question and so on. So, any information that refers to anything after the 9th of February, then that, it immediately your guidance is that we're going to do in such an hour, Mr. Speaker.
No problem. Question number 109, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
I would like to be able to provide you to question number 749 of 2014. Can the Minister for Housing provide revised and updated details of how many homes still remain unsold in the special government's new co-ownership housing project, given the room size competition in each state?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Children, Courts and Social Services in Housing.
The government's new co-ownership housing projects are a huge success, and there are no homes remaining unsold.
Question number 110, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of how much has been given up in respect of unpaid rent pertaining to government rental homes since the answer provided to question number 35 of 2015.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Children, Reforms and Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 117.
Question number 117, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
The Minister for Housing provide details for the arrears in his point in respect of unpaid rent pertaining to government rental homes as at 31st January 2015.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Children, Equality, Social and Services, Paid Holidays.
Mr. Speaker, nothing has been written up since the answer provided to question number 35 of 2015, what in respect of the arrears continues. Proposal of arrears and unpaid rent as at 31st of January 2015 is 5,368,667 pounds. I can not say very much about the amount that are older than 6 years, which is not enough for recovery.
I just think that again, I like the bit of hearing. Again, the minimum of, sorry, the figure of 5,358,660. What you see in the frame is a figure that does not include something that has been euthanized at this time of the trial tonight, and I'm able to put it up here. Well, yes, it's right. Has anything been written off because it's been more than 6 years?
Question number 111, the Honourable E. J. Hayden.
Only Minister for Housing provide details in respect of all expenditure occurred since the answer to question number 36 of 2015 in respect of contracts awarded for making empty homes suitable for relocation, stating to whom payments were made, how much has been paid, the number of residential homes pertaining to each payment, as well as indicating the type or nature of repair work or cleaning services undertaken.
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Fairness, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, information for the month of January 2015 is as follows. In relation to one property awarded to AJEC, it costs £8,444, and to E. Lever and Sons Limited, £4,450.
And the nature type of work undertaken, Mr. Speaker?
Sorry, Mr. Speaker. All services contracted within repairs and manual of cleaning.
What type of repair, Mr. Speaker? Is it, you know, what nature, what type of repair? Is it repair to the roof, to the insulation? I remember the wording from last month, and you suggested, Mr. Speaker, that it, you know, it's just a repair, and I don't even know this day or the type of repair.
Mr. Speaker, the only information I can provide with is that there are general repairs. And imagine that when a property is essentially repaired, we have different issues. Mr. Speaker, they're not food repairs because the figures aren't that big.
You know, to do with the plumbing work that you do in the electrical work, or who's there, please, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sorry, I don't have any further information because the officials have not provided information.
Would the Honourable Lady please instruct officials to look at the question carefully to the suggested type on the first report? Question 112, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
The Speaker, the Minister for Housing provides details of how many tenants required urgent detention from their homes since the answer to question number 37 of 2015, indicating the reason why, the date when said detention became necessary, and the date when the tenants were able to return to their homes.
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Children, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, three tenants have required detention from their homes for the following reasons. On account of a fire since the 23rd of January 2015, and another on account of work on the 12th of February 2015, two on account of work, one from the 12th of February and one from the 13th of February, and no special for the term has yet been decided.
And what do you say, Madam Speaker? Any idea what type of work?
No, Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid I do not have that level of detail.
Question number 113, the Honourable E. J. Hayes.
Further to the answer provided to question number 39 of 2015, can the Minister for Housing in the United States with a building surveyor and energy driver listed under seconded in the schedule provided, were even seconded out from or into the housing work agency?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Housing, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, the building surveyor and Jay will be defending eight for the voting rights agency.
Question number 114, the Honourable E.J. Bailey. Finally, Minister for Housing and Social Matters claims to have been involved in excessive legal costs relating to the eviction of quarters from government rental homes since the answer provided to question number 41 of 2015, providing the breakdown showing the number of homes involved and to whom payments were made. Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, there will be no expenditure incurred since the answer provided to 41 of 2015.
Question number 115, the Honourable E.J. Bailey. Mr. Speaker, further to the answer provided to written question number W17 of 2015. Can the Minister for Housing provide details showing which of the five collective reasons listed in the schedule corresponding to flats which are currently vacant apply in each individual case, together with details of the room composition of each individual home? Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, of the 159 single flats, 12 1RKBs, or the ones that are beyond economic repair are 12 1RKBs, 29 4RKBs, 25 3RKBs, 7 4RKBs, 6 5RKBs, 3 6RKBs. Of those considered possible for sale or tender, there are 5 1RKBs, 16 2RKBs, 23 3RKBs, 10 4RKBs, 7 5RKBs, and 1 7RKBs. Of those ready for allocation now, there's 1 1RKB and 2 4RKBs and 1 9RKB. And refurbished but not yet allocated, 3 1RKBs, 4 3RKBs, 2 4RKBs, 2 5RKBs. And now in relation to the 58 so-called flats, the breakdown is as follows. Of those which are beyond economical repair, 8 1RKBs, 3 2RKBs, 3 2RKBs. For those considered possible for sale or tender, those that are in-house and ready for allocation, 4 1RKBs, 4 2RKBs, 4 3RKBs, 3 4RKBs. And refurbished, 7 1RKBs, 6 4RKBs, 9 3RKBs, 6 4RKBs, and 1 5RKBs.
Question number 116, the Honourable E.J. Bailey. Can the Minister for Housing provide a breakdown of costs in respect of the recent resettlement work at the operation for Governor's Mother House in Alameda State, stating which company carried out the work and indicating that these are now complete and approved by government quality control officials? I say the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, the works were awarded and completed by Limiton Company Limited for the sum of £3,500 and DGCC staff have supervised the work.
Question number 117, the Honourable E.J. Bailey. Question number 118, the Honourable Mr. Ireland Hammond.
If I may be able to imagine, the Honourable Member was the one that asked the question to him today, so I would like to say to him that the £2,098 that he asked in the previous question as to the enactment society and association was exactly what I said to him with the work on the uniform.
Question number 118, the Honourable Mr. Adam Elizabeth.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services say when the definition of disabled will change to ensure that all those who suffer disability at whatever stage in their lives will be entitled to disability benefits? What criteria will be used to define disability, and at what stage is government in the review of disability in our laws?
I say the Honourable Minister for Children, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
We will answer this question together with question 109.
Question 119, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna O'Hanlon.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services say when the government will legislate for further protection of disabled people, ratifying and using the terms of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Disabled Persons as a model?
I say the Honourable Minister for Children, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, in regard to changing the definition in relation to disability allowance, this forms part of a wider review of the benefit system and is work in progress. Legislation to ratify the UN Convention is drafted and is in the final stages of review and about to go to consultation very, very soon.
Question 120, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna O'Hanlon.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services say if there are plans to increase the number of self-assessed and respite places for the disabled and service users of St. Bernadette Resource Centre?
I say the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, St. Bernadette Resource Centre is a great centre for adults with learning disabilities and does not provide staff or respite. The provision of disability services is continuously under review and is monitored depending on demand.
Question number 121, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna O'Hanlon.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services say how many companies in Gibraltar form part of the supported employment scheme which offers further employment to service users of St. Bernadette Resource Centre and the Doctors of Idaho?
I say the Honourable Minister for Children, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, there is one company.
Question number 122, the Honourable G.A. Stephen. Mr. Speaker, is the figure of £2.6 million the final cost of the Doctor Hirai inquiry, or does the government envisage a civil increase? I say the Honourable Minister for Children, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker,
£2.6
million is not the final cost of the inquiry, and government expects to receive further invoices. And we make a statement once the final cost has been determined.
The cost of 161 is running over on Mr. Booking. I'm trying to say it. 161. Question number 159, the Honourable Dean Davis. The
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Financial Services provide details of the business development goals which the Flagship Development has?
I said the Honourable Minister for Financial Services is in you.
The Honourable Member will be aware that the next event arranged with Gibraltar Finance arranges a central event with private meetings previously arranged around them and timed to coincide with international conference events in each of the jurisdictions.
The reason for this is simply to enable professionals in the private sector to attend the international conference, attend the flagship event, and also, where appropriate, participate in the private meetings arranged during that visit. Further, we always take the opportunity during these events to engage with international media in order to further raise the profile of Gibraltar as a quality and reputable financial services center. This initiative has led to engagement with six local media and on our recent visit to the Bloomberg interview in Hong Kong with CNBC Asia and RHK, a major Hong Kong radio station, both with live interviews. In London, with a live interview on Sky News and a Business Today program, and in Bermuda with a TV and newspaper interview. Our goal in all of the above is, of course, to promote Gibraltar as a quality and reputable international financial services center, in partnership with the private sector firms, by proactively marketing the benefits of our proposition, stressing that Gibraltar offers a well-regulated, transparent, and internationally cooperative jurisdiction with access to financial markets, including the right of access to the European Union's single market in financial services. The recently released Business Development Plan of 2015 details the precise events and conferences we will be supporting this year, which exceed 30 different events across the spectrum of our financial services community. The program has been discussed with and considered by the Finance Centre Council, who have warmly welcomed the development plan and are actively supporting our efforts to promote the jurisdiction. With respect to the flagship event, I would comment as follows. These past 12 months, we've organized the Board of the Atlantic in five different cities from Bermuda, Hong Kong, Geneva, Zurich, and London, and hosting over 910 guests, including some 200 local professionals supporting these initiatives. These numbers give you an indication of the magnitude of the project we have embarked on and the extent of the support that we have received from those attending and, of course, our local firms. The opportunity to engage directly with professionals in each of these jurisdictions and address them on the basis of our jurisdiction, hand in hand with the private sector, is an effective and efficient means of promoting business links and new financial hubs with our professionals. These events, together with attending conferences and roadshows and engagement with media, are all part of the program of increasing serious awareness of our jurisdiction and catching up on the many years of a lack of investment in this area. In addition, our senior executives are constantly engaging with professionals in news and other markets promoting the growth proposition. I would like to sincerely thank the entire team of Gibraltar Finance for their conscientious work and attention to detail in ensuring that whatever function we organize or attend, we always do so perfectly prepared and our presence professionally delivered. Question number 150, the Honourable DJ Rafiri. Can the Minister for Financial Services provide details of his department's travel expenses to date for 2015? I answer the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming. Yes, Mr. Speaker, the travel expenses of the Finance Centre Department paid to date for 2015 are hotels, £4,029, flights, £10,461.28, subscriptions and expenses of £903. These costs relate to invoices paid in 2015 up to the 16th of February 2015. And if I may just add, Mr. Speaker, included within those numbers is one visit to London, which is cancelled due to my inability to go to serious veterans, which we are in the process of recovering the cost of doing the same thing. I'm grateful for that reply, Mr. Speaker. Just to be very clear in my own mind, the giving a set of figures is the fact that when information has been uploaded, you and I have had a debate across the floor of the House in relation to asking questions in such a matter which are available in the internet and government website. The information which I thought I was speaking in the question has actually been provided online, and it was updated, I think, on the 15th of February, which close to the filing of the question, Mr. Speaker. Now,
information online relates to four specific events which took place 2 in January and 2 in February. The total amount of which I calculate to be about 9,250, well, about the specific figure, is 9351 and 30 cents. Now, the information is given is not in tandem with this. Can you explain why? Basically, I really want to get updated information. So, giving me different information.
Mr. Speaker, the major difference to this, what you have on the website will be, I think, ministerial travel, and the question is phrased in the department travel. So, including the Board of Finance, includes, for example, the members of the Board of Finance team, the minister and the chairman, that travel to set up the exhibition in London, in Zurich. So there are different expenses, so you will not be able to relate the information I've given directly to the ones that are on the website, to be aware that the people involved, the divorce filing team is on the website on the same page that you're referring to.
But the information again would have included this information on the website because it's personal expenses, or I know it's
there. The information I have been provided, the breakdown for the numbers that I've just given you, which total, I think, 10,129, whatever it is. So, what they've done is they've structured my costs and given you the ministry's costs. For example, it includes the cost of a visit to Madrid for a LEIRC conference of £95 and £129 of the cost. That's not on my website, but that's included in these numbers. And if the only one member would like to have more details, I'm happy to let him have them by letter, giving a breakdown of the specific cost relating to each member of the Board of Finance in respect of each day's visit, which may be of more use to him than the generic paper breakdown.
And yes, I probably will be seeking that information from him, perhaps. I get the information from the prepared answer once it's in hand, so I get the name, and then I'll take it to Google once I've had a proper chance of reading it and comparing it with the information. So he's been helpful in his reply. Now, what I've noticed is in terms of making comparison to how much was spent last year and this year in terms of his travel expenses, there is a threefold increase. So, for example, up until March, his travel expenditure, or we say, was about £3,500, while the information provided on the website suggests that he's already spent £9,300. So, with a visit to Hong Kong, for example, which wasn't included in the previous year. But, and this is where it was leading to. Does he envisage that the overall annual cost, given that the he must have a plan in the country that is published in the development plan, the overall annual cost is going to be higher, and if so, does he have an idea of how much that overall annual for 2015?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the difference between last year and this year, obviously, is that there was a visit to Hong Kong in January this year, and there wasn't a visit to Hong Kong in January last year. In terms of the overall spending, The business development plan that was issued in January has been costed. The expenditure that was in last year's estimate was below the amount that was required to meet the business development plan. So there's been a supplemental funding request made to the financial policy this year, and we are within the budget in terms of what the original estimate was and the supplemental funding request, which covered the entire year of the business plan. Does that answer your question? It's above the estimated amount last year, but within the budget that we set through the supplemental plan request. Question number 161, the Honourable E. J. Taylor. Can we make a presentation to provide details of any changes to member teams since the answer to question number 64? 2015, in respect to supply teachers and or the force of civil staff currently engaged by the Department of Education.
Also, the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Chester, and from the set of my ancestors, question 54 of 2015, the only change to report is that out of the 10 supply chain exemptions, 8 have been made permanent, and the other 2 are in the process of being recruited. One at Bayside School and one at Bishop Fitzgerald Middle School. Honourable members will recall that one of the subjects, question 54 in particular, table 4, there was a reference to 10 part-time cleaners with a remark telling saying in the process of being recruited. 8 of those have now been recruited, and 2 are in the process of being recruited. And the only other change, Mr. Speaker, in respect of the tables previously given, is not a change in actual circumstances, but simply the filling of a gap, which the honourable member will recall in table 1, to say that under the leader for cover, which was supply teachers, there was a gap in one of the teachers covering up the college. And I now have that information to report that the reason for the cover is an SEN life skills course, which I know that the honourable member will recognize as that. And that is a specific life skills course that has been delivered over the course of this year for people of special educational needs. And that is a special cover which has been done over the whole of the academic year. Those are the only two changes in the process. I'm really grateful to see that there'll be actual information. I know it's just a month since the last time, but I pose this question now because it has been the Department of Education and the last time to consolidate any information and amendments required from the start of the term. And therefore, I'm satisfied now that I was in free pick that at least for the remainder of this term. Thank you.
Question number 162, the Honourable D.A. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, please provide a full breakdown of what every government subsidized student studying outside the doors is studying, breaking down by A course, B university, C whether the course is an undergraduate or postgraduate course, and D the cost of each course.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
The information request is set out in the schedule written in my hand to the Honourable Member. Yes. Mr. Speaker, I will wait for the schedule to be handed over. I'll wait for the Honourable Member to see the information and his particular comments in relation to the schedule. This is a complex
information we have to discuss with me and 900 students on the district grounds in the 162.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, can I have the question
before I come to the
question? Yes, Mr. Speaker, to that answer. And as the Honourable Mr. Speaker has mentioned, this is a list in respect of 856 students. 856 students which have appeared to be funded fully funded to study outside Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, I can rightly say that that is an extraordinary number of students to be funded by the government to study outside Gibraltar in a community for communities such as ours. And it includes that list, not just undergraduate students, but also postgraduate students, including masters and PhDs. And that's where our defense has arisen as a result of a change in policy by the government, which decided that the mandatory scholarship scheme was to apply not only to undergraduate students, but also to postgraduate students who wanted to do a master's or further in the government. And it's just decided to say that this record, which is set out in the schedule, is a record which the Gibraltar as a community can largely be proud of.
I suggest to the Honourable Minister the next time that he provides such a schedule, instead of referring to St. Mary's University College, it should be St. Mary's University, Twickenham. If you came into the university last year, it's no longer the University College. It should appear as St. Mary's University College, it's now the university. And it's called St. Mary's University, Twickenham.
The former sovereign here in Corinth is now from the University of Sydney.
Three pages from the back, which says that University of Malta, medicine, and a real fee for both. The two entries for University of Malta, medicine, no fee. And can you just explain why there are no fees in the University of Malta, when there are fees in respect of all the other entries?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I can certainly do that. And the honourable member will know that 2 weeks ago I was in Malta, Malta has a scheme whereby the University of Malta, provides free education for students. And in providing free education for students, it is free education not just for students, but EU students. And therefore, Gibraltar students that seek to go to the University of Malta. And in fact, the University of Malta's Faculty of Medicine is a very prestigious and well-known Faculty of Medicine and produces some very, very good professionals from that university. And we have two of our own students in that faculty. Yes, the education is in English, absolutely. And we have two of our students studying at this prestigious college at no cost to the government, because that is the model that the University of Malta, or that Malta, as a jurisdiction, has decided. It provides free education for students, and then by extension, it also means free education for EU students.
And so on the goal of 1975, Dr. Albert G. Winning was studying medicine at the University of Malta, and I took a notion when I was with the driver. 1975.
Mr. Speaker, that seems fundamentally different to the same argument that applies to the entry in respect of student number 117 at Dundee University, undertaking an undergraduate course in architecture. And it says the same multi Scotland.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that is indeed the position. That is indeed the position, although I understand that the position in Scotland has now changed, and that the students from outside Scotland do now pay a fee. I simply call it, if the honourable member will remind me of the My understanding is that in respect of new students in Scotland, there will be fees charged. But this is one that has started already at the time of the system was that no fees were charged to start before studying in Scotland. And I know this because it also caught my eye, and when I was still in this, I asked this specific question that the honourable member got.
The only one is a figure with any sense and with a native one I know not to. The student that listed in 117, the publication is an MA, which one reads as a master of arts. Normally, the master's degree is recorded as postgraduate rather than undergraduate. And on the right-hand side column, he's done as an undergraduate. I list the numbers of the same, and it keeps us in real time and money. Undergraduate is normally actually obtaining the bachelor's degree, and then you can be doing that as a degree of postgraduate. The minister may need some time to check with the Department of Education on that one, but it does seem that there's plans to contribute to the same. Yes, Mr. Speaker, that was one that I missed when I went through the local Irish Act.
Mr. Speaker, it's a fascinating list that I'll hopefully get just the last supplementary that we will ask in this time we have. But 95 to 98, there are four entries, Faculty of Medicine in the Czech Republic, and they're all studying, four students studying medicine. Is that in Czech or is it in English as well?
in the... I understand that there's a lot of competition for medicine in the United Kingdom, and people are looking for alternatives. This is actually the Czech Republic, medicine in the Czech Republic. Well, I'm just asking the question whether it's in Czech or whether it's in English that the course is provided.
whether his marriage was killed at the end of that movie. And I'm going to put you another person who the honourable gentleman referred to in this house, wants to make sure that he pays his own cost of travel to my kids, having said his name up to go to the areas. I have already told you the answer to living questions number 719 to government 23 of 2016 inclusive.
In the House Canal, the details of the President. Over the day, there is 32nd reading. One, a bill for an act to amend the Gibraltar Revenue Act 1998. The Honourable Peter Nicholson.
Are the Honourable familiar with the bill for an act to amend the Gibraltar Revenue Act 1998? You read it first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Gibraltar Revenue Act 1998 be read the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Gibraltar Resident Amendment 2014.
The Speaker, we also move the bill for the Gibraltar Resident Amendment Act 2015 be read a second time. The Speaker, this bill updates the Gibraltar Resident Act, which is an act that is in its current form, dated back to 1998. But in fact applies the Army Act 1955. Changes to legislation concerning the armed forces have been significant over the years in the United Kingdom. The Army Act 1955 is no longer in force, having been swept away by the Armed Forces Act 2006, and this bill seeks to bring the Royal Gibraltar Regiment up to date in respect of disciplinary matters dealt with in those pieces of legislation. The Speaker calls two of the bill makes amendments to both the long and short titles of the Act so that the legislation will reflect the conformance of the Royal Peacock, which was proudly awarded to the regiment in 1999 after the Act amendment. Clause 3 of the bill updates definitions within the Act, and Clause 4 replaces existing Section 3 and 4 of the Act and sets out the basis for the establishment, maintenance, and disbandment of the RDR, although for the Speaker, nobody in support can imagine that the RDR should ever be disbanded, but there has to be provision for it, and there was in the old Act. The Speaker, Clause 6 of the Act, renamed Part 2 of the Act, to be recorded for part related to prison countries, and Clause 7 inserts new sections to the Act. Act Section 5 sets out the purposes of the Part, which is to provide for its disciplinary framework on the same terms as their UK counterparts for soldiers who are members of the regiment to the border. Section 5A relates to who the part applies to and deems such persons to be personally subject to service law. In that context, the House will note that the Act will only apply to two classes of persons, effectively those in uniform, and to a much more limited extent to those who were in uniform but have left the regiment. This section is important because in the UK there is a further class of persons to whom service law applies. These are described as civilians who are subject to service discipline. Such persons could include spouses, partners, and other family members of enrolled persons. As far as this act is concerned, nothing in service law can apply to such persons in Gibraltar. Section 5B makes further provisions after the application of service law, and in particular restricts the application of service law, and it will be contrary to the UK constitution, the unwritten constitution. This section also restricts the application of service law to the extent provided for in Schedule 2A. The House will note that the purpose of Schedule 2A is to restrict the implementation of service law to what we might colloquially call within the wire, i.e. the energy of service. Section 5C modified service also can be applied in Gibraltar and were appropriate in accordance with our legislation and procedures. Section 5D provides the basis for the enforcement in Gibraltar of the outcomes of the disciplinary proceedings. And Section 5E provides a regulation making power for the purposes of counsel a person for the side of their liberty. Section 5F will permit the amendment of service law by a subsidiary legislation, albeit the House will have power over any such amendment. And 5G relates to persons absenting themselves without leave and provides that warrants may be obtained and granted by legislative justice.
5-8 ensures that a civil criminal court does not lose the right to try a person who may have committed an offense outside of the law. Clause 8 of the bill updates the provisions of Section 6 of the Act of Connection, which connection with the enforcement of the regiment. Clause 10 of the bill amends Section 8 of the Act of Connection with the commands of the regiment, and Clause 11 recasts the nationality requirements for entry into the regiment in keeping with the UK law. The provisions of the Act concerning liability for service are recast in Section 15A-17 as set out in Clause 12 of the bill. Clauses 12-16 of the bill are minor amendments, some relate to typographical nomenclature. Clause 13 provides a regulation that empowers the government to issue regulations, etc., of an administrative nature, and Clause 18 repeals Clause 1, which provides the terms and conditions of service, and which in terms of maintenance of data can be better provided for outside the confines of the Act. Clause 19 includes Clause 2 and 3, and these represent service rates, which is to apply to RGE personnel. And Clause 21 reproduces Clause 4 with a number of minor amendments. Mr. Speaker, I will be moving during the course of the committee stage some amendments to the Welsh Water Regiment Amendment Bill. I have a letter which will be distributed to honourable members, but perhaps if people are able to be of more assistance, I can offer whoever is going to speak on this subject from the other side if they wish. I don't want to make 17 copies, but I make one copy for me and one copy for member deputies if they wish it. Of both a marked up version of the Act that we are amending with the amendment, and also a marked up version of the bill to reflect the amendments that are being proposed at the committee stage. And if anybody on that side is going to speak on the bill wants to have a copy, I'm quite happy to let them have one. There is another copy coming that needs to be printed, and that can be circulated in time for the debate on the committee stage.
Before I put the question, the Honourable Member would like to speak on the general principles and limits of this bill.
Mr. Speaker, the position will be supporting the bill. Mr. Speaker, from my recollection, from my time as Minister for Justice, this was something that was discussed when we were in government. Certainly, we would have brought a similar bill to this afternoon. And therefore, the opposition is going to be supporting the government in relation to this particular thing. I'm grateful for that invitation, Mr. Speaker. And now, put the question, which is that the Bill for an Act for members of both the government of 1998 is held a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The road to both the Regulate Amendment Act 2014.
I beg to be noted that the committee says in third reading of the bill be taken today, and all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that the committee says in third reading of the bill be taken today.
To a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997. The Honourable the Minister for Education and Justice and International Exchange of Information.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act be moved the first time. Be read the first time, sir.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 be read the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Tobacco Amendment Number 3 Act 2014.
The Speaker, I beg to move that the bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 be read a second time. The Speaker, this bill amends the Tobacco Act so as to clarify for the avoidance of doubt situations where certain services may be carried out under the Act. This clarification reflects the operation of the Act and the search powers thereunder since 1999. And allowed for the search without a warrant of any vehicle into water where a police or customs officer has reasonable grounds to suspect that cigarettes in certain countries constitute the provisions of the Tobacco Act 1997 may be found within. This amendment clarifies that officers have the same powers in dealing with locally registered vehicles as they deal with foreign registered vehicles. And just to explain the issue, if I can read what the current statute says, it's Chapter 17C1, says every police or customs officer shall have free access to any vehicle, any vessel, or aircraft at the port or airport, and of any vehicle brought into Gibraltar, whether a vehicle is likely to suspect that may be found in that vessel, aircraft, or motor vehicle, in circumstances contrary to the provisions of this act, and may, and then accept that be the carriage. It's a reference to brought into Gibraltar that has displayed the interpretation that has been given previously is that every vehicle had at some stage been brought into Gibraltar, and therefore the carriage had always existed. But given that the matter was raised, this is just an amendment for the avoidance of doubt that refers to every vehicle in Gibraltar. Whether it's brought in the day before or 2 years before is irrelevant. It now relates to any vehicle in Gibraltar, or it will when the next part of the amendment and the bill is brought into effect. Speak, I commend the bill to the House.
I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on these any of those principles in relation to the bill?
Mr. Speaker, let's just say that we obviously be supporting the bill. And only to really, and also, it's rather curious in that it will appear an issue that it does have to be dealt with. And this would be definitely interesting, I'm sure, in this area. I have to understand in what circumstances it actually arose that the things have been required, but clearly it's not a point of contention at all, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
And now for the question.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, I've received representations from the Commission of Customs about the need to insert an additional power in respect of the Tobacco Act, in respect of powers of second search in special zones, Mr. Speaker. And we propose that because of the urgency of dealing with this issue with tobacco and having received these representations, shortly, in the fact in the space of the last 14 days from the collection session, which is to take the opportunity of using this active bill, which has been to amend the tobacco, to make the further amendment. A letter will be circulated to all the members setting out what the proposed amendment is, but they will see that it is literally something that is additional power to special search in special zones. The advice that we have through the collection in the Attorney General's office is that this is what the previous committee used to call giving retrospective legal cover is necessary in respect of the way that supplement searching has been happening today for special zones and how it might be able to continue to happen in the future to ensure, much as the Liberal Gentleman said in respect of the main amendment, which was in the Green copy, that they would make an argument to suggest that there isn't a power there, but nobody has previously challenged. There is advice now on my concerns in the future, and I would say that in the amendment which will be circulated.
I'll put the question, if you've got a bill for our last time, please come up to the radical act.
Mr. Speaker, if you move over the bill for our respond to the issue that's raised by the honourable member. Mr. Speaker, the honourable member has discussed the circumstances which this talk is about, and it's essentially that it was brought to my attention that someone, maybe some lawyer, might at some point raise in court that there are no carriers except locally registered vehicles. And so if we use nothing to challenge, although we don't believe that that was ever the intention of the bill or that it would ever happen, if we use nothing to challenge, if somebody might raise it, it was suggested that I should make this amendment just for the sake of clarity. That's what I was speaking for tonight.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act for members of the Tobacco Act 1997 is read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Aye. The Tobacco Amendment Number 3 Act 2014.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to the notice of the committee for the third reading of the bill be taken today before honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree, the committee stays on third reading of the bill be taken today. A bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011. The Honourable the Minister for Education and Justice and International Exchange Information.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that a Dayfront Act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a Dayfront Act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 be read a first time. Those in favour, raise again, carried. The Criminal Procedure and Evidence Amendment Number 2 Act 2014.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that a bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill amends the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 to act to ensure that when calculating the length of a sentence to be served, time spent on remand counts towards just one sentence of imprisonment. The need for this amendment follows two recent cases before the Supreme Court in Gibraltar, which adhere to the interpretation of the current Section 497 of the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011. The first of these cases was heard when an application for a writ of habeas corpus, whereas the second was during the sentencing process. Section 497 was held to be mandatory in that the length of a sentence must be reduced by the time the person has been in custody in connection with proceedings for that defendant. This is appropriate, Mr. Speaker, in circumstances where that person is solely serving or solely on demand for that offence, but not where the person is serving is a serious sentence for another offence or is remanded in custody for more than one offence. In those circumstances, it is only right that the time spent on demand or in police custody should only count once towards one sentence. This is a position in the United Kingdom and one that this government believes must have been the intention when this act was passed. Mr. Speaker, just to put that in general context, if somebody is already serving a sentence of imprisonment and goes to court and is demanded in custody in respect of another offence, that person, as this has been interpreted, has the advantage of that same period in demand being counted twice. Once in respect of the serving of the period he's already serving, and once in respect of the new sentence if he was to be sentenced respectively to the new offence. In one occasion, I understand that the court re-sentenced the individual, changed the sentence once the sentence was brought to the court of sentence, so as to give effect to, or rather, for us not to give effect to that sentence. As I mentioned when I introduced the bill, the position of the United Kingdom is what we consider must have been the intention of carrying it from the past to this and as a result of the two cases that have arisen, the court is doing it, that it is only right to be clarified that a person should not get the benefit for in this kind of situation. I commend the vote to the House.
Before I put the question, is any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and measures of the bill?
Mr. Speaker, I also need to confirm that the Commission will be supporting the bill, not only the service to act to the
deputy. I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 to the vote of second time. Those in favour? Those again, carried.
The Criminal Procedure and Evidence Amendment Number 2 Act 2014. Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice of the committee statement third reading of the bill to be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee statement third reading of the bill be taken today?
Four. A bill for an act to amend the International Corporation Tax Information Act 2011. The Honourable Minister for Education and Justice and International Exchange of Information. I think I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the International Corporation Tax Information Act 2009 to be read a first time.
I now put the question to you that a bill for an act to amend the International Corporation Tax Information Act 2009 to be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The International Corporation Tax Information Amendment Act 2008. I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. The Speaker, the Act contains the definition of minister, currently as the Minister with Responsibility for Finance. And as the House knows, there was a reshuffle on the 9th of December 2011, whereby specific responsibility for international exchange of information was created and entered the ministerial responsibility. And I was charged with that job. And therefore, given that we now have a minister with responsibility for international exchange of information, it is appropriate that that is the minister that has responsibility under the Act, and therefore the definition of the minister in the Act is simply amended to reflect the change in cabinet responsibilities in this area.
Is any honourable member to speak on the general principles and matters of the bill? I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the International Corporation Tax Information Act 2009 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Sorry. The International Corporation Tax Information Amendment Act 2014.
If our best to give notice of the committee statement, third reading of the bill will be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee statement, third reading of the bill will be taken today?
Five. A bill for an act to amend the Parliament Act. The Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GST. I think I'm going to say something that you feel better than something. I have the honor to move for the bill for a night to amend the text of the Parliament Act with the first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Parliament Act to vote the first time. Those in favor? Those against? Carried. The Parliament Amendment Act 2014. I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. The Speaker, the bill introduces in respect of members of this House the option of being able to commute 100% of their pension, which already exists for civil servants and for assisted communities just for the private sector. When the maximum 25% reduces the operation of pensions is first removed under the previous administration. As the law stands at the moment, Section 94.1 has two subsections A and B, and the Section A is the one that limits the commutation to one quarter of the pension at the maximum. And the B is the multiplier that produces the value of recommendation to produce the future. What the new provisions do is, in fact, they reflect in Section 1 the provisions of ARERA, and now there is a new Section 2 which simply says that the option can be to have 100% commutation and take no income at all. I recommend the bill to the House. I put the question, is any of the members of the general principles and matters of the bill? And I put the question, which is a bill for an act to amend the Parliament Act to vote the second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Parliament Amendment Act 2014. It is noted that the committee statement third reading of the bill be taken today, all members of it. All of honourable members agree that the committee statement says we have a big decision today. There is only one clause, and if you do it in committee state,
you can come back to the chart again and again until you understand or whatever formulation is chosen. Raise them up in the meeting.
Colleges said and third reading, the Honourable Chief Minister.
I have learned to move that the House now resolves the committee and consider the following bills proposed by the floor. Namely, we should vote for a resolution at the President's Amendment Bill 2014, the Tobacco Amendment Number 3 Bill 2014, the Forest Procedure Evidence Amendment Number 2 Bill 2014, the Council Corporation Constitution Amendment Bill 2014, and the Parliament Amendment Bill 2014.
A bill for an act to amend the Divorce and Regulations Act 1998. Bill 1.
Time card of the bill. Mr. Speaker, for the benefit of dealing with this issue in my way of the expedition, and given the honourable member of the bill has amended, in other words, they have both the amendment to the principal act that we are amending in Mark Act, and they have also this bill with the amendments marked out, and the letter that sets out what amendments are being proposed, which they would have seen deal with the basis they put in the speech. If they agree, would they take those as read? It would be useful if I had a copy of the letter so that I know at which point, at which clause is being amended. It's easier for me. I notice, therefore, that for instance, in clause 1, there is an amendment, which is just a substitution of 2015 for 2014. So, all of the members agree with that amendment, and therefore, people we can treat the letter as effectively removing the amendment, so we don't have to go through the amendment every single clause. I think, procedurally, they should be. What I will do is, for this clause, I will ask honourable members to agree that the amendment of which the Chief Minister has given notice be incorporated, be agreed to. That's how we, just without having to ask you who did that. Okay? But as I say, in clause 1, there is this straightforward amendment substitution in the year 2015 for 2014. Agreed? Okay. Now, clause 2. Clause 2, do all honourable members agree with the amendment of which the Chief Minister has given notice? No, in clause 2, there is a clause 2, stand part of the bill. Clause 3, there is an amendment to clause 3, the Chief Minister has circulated. Are all honourable members happy with it? Is there any point that we should raise? Clauses 4 to 6. So, Clause 3 has amended some part of the bill. Clauses 4 to 6. Clauses 4 to 6. Those in favour? Those against? Clauses 4 to 6. Some part of the bill. Clause 7. With amendments. In clause 7, there is an amendment which is seeking to start giving the notice. Are all members supporting the amendment? So clause 7, as amended, stands part of the bill. Clauses 8 and 9. Clauses 8 and 9 stand part of the bill. Clause 10 with amendments. Clause 10, an amendment has been circulated by the Chief Minister. Those in favour? Those against? Clause 10, as amended, stands part of the bill. Clauses 11 to 18.
verses 11 to 18, stand part of the bill. Clause 19 of the amendment. Clause 19, an amendment has been circulated. Those in favour? Those against? Have it. Clause 19, as amended, stand part of the bill. Clause 20 of the amendment. There is also an amendment to clause 20. Those in favour? Those against? Clause 20, as amended, stand part of the bill. Clause 21 of the amendment. Clause 21, there is a very simple amendment of which notice has been given. Those in favour? Those against? Clause 21, as amended, stand part of the bill. Clause 22. Clause 22, stand part of the bill. The long title, stand part of the bill. A bill, two, a bill for that to amend the Tobacco Act 1997. Clause 1, stand part of the bill. Clause 2, with amendments.
There is an amendment that I've spoken to the Honourable Minister for Justice in respect of behind the scenes amendment to this, and that is to the amendment to clause 11BA, 11BA2. The amendment currently reads for a personal vehicle who constructs pursuant to subsection 1, and for lease or customs officer, I suggested that we add A, so it's an A for the customs officer. As reasonable grounds for believing that an offence committed or is being committed, that officer may search that person, any article that person has with him, and then it goes on to say, and any vehicle, comma, including any other persons in that vehicle. I suggest to the Honourable Minister that we might want to make sure that it's not just any vehicle in the vicinity other than the one that's been stopped, and therefore I would suggest that it be amended to read. That officer may search that person, any article that person has with him, comma, the vehicle, comma, including any other persons in that vehicle. So I can read it again if it's
I think the Honourable Member needs to write it out. The Member, that is proposing.
I think it's a secret, and it's a secret. We've got some amendments like that on the file.
Is that anyone that's seen the amendment?
I can talk it with the Honourable Member,
yes. And I have to discuss it with the Honourable Member. I'm happy to reflect things to the wording used by the Honourable Member. The last thing. Subclause 2, the last two lines to be decommitted, that officer may search that person, comma, any article that person has with him, comma, their vehicle, and any other person in that vehicle. Slightly confused because this is an amendment I take it to clause 2. Alright? That's the one that I have written in the two minutes? Okay, no. That is an amendment to the current one. Section 11 B. There is a further amendment to that. Then the correct procedure would therefore be for the Chief Minister to move the amendment of which I have been given notice, and then for the Honourable Member, who's having that amendment before the committee, for the Honourable Member to move an amendment to his amendment. That is the correct procedure.
government motion, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. This House welcomes the long and historic relationship between the Royal Anglian Regiment and its fallen residents, and Gibraltar. Recalls that throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, residents from the Royal Anglian counties of Essex, Northamptonshire, Suffolk, Lincolnshire, and Norfolk were posted to Gibraltar to defend the rock and its people. Recalls that both the 12th Regiment, the forerunner of the Suffolk Regiment, and the 56th Foot, the forerunner of the Essex Regiment, defended Gibraltar during the Great Siege of 1779 to 1783, and that the 12th Regiment formed the main body of the Grand Forces of November 1781. And take place with the recognition of the efforts of the 12th Regiment, the Castle and Sea, and the name Gibraltar were taken at its death, and that the former remains there to this day in the Royal Anglian Regimental Crest. Recall that in May 1969, a formal affiliation was announced between the Royal Anglian Regiment and the then Gibraltar Regiment, and that there have been many instances of Royal Gibraltar Regiment soldiers serving abroad with the Royal Anglians in places like Northern Ireland, Germany, Cyprus, Belize, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and declared that the freedom of the city of Gibraltar be conferred on the Royal Anglian Regiment in view of its historic and close connection with Gibraltar and its people. Mr. Speaker, this is a motion protecting this survey that it stands to speak for itself. The people of Gibraltar have long and historically, not just with the United Kingdom, but with the Ministry of Defence in particular, and with part of the Ministry of Defence who have been particularly responsible for the defence and protection of Gibraltar and its people at some key times in our history. Mr. Speaker, the Ministry of Defence in Gibraltar still celebrates the Grand Forty of November 1781, in some style, as I was able to attest to it this year, and I think the leader of the opposition was willing that we enjoyed a sumptuous banquet in St. Michael's Day, demonstrating the importance of that date, even in this time of austerity for the Ministry of Defence. The Great Forty or Grand Forty was an important date in history. The Speaker, the Anglians were here then, and they were here at other important times in the history of Gibraltar, that those who understand how it is that in military terms the defense of this fortress has been achieved, sometimes in light of almost impossible odds, will recognize the importance of the limits that we continue to enjoy with two regiments such as the Royal Anglian, one of the few regiments that has not disappeared in recent amalgamation, etc., of the UK infantry. Mr. Speaker, in the circumstances, I don't suppose you say anything more, but I do understand that this motion would be enjoying the support of the whole House as it should, and that we will all be very pleased indeed when we are able to make the arrangements for members of the Royal Anglian Regiment serving today to come to Gibraltar to receive the freedom of the city on behalf of this Parliament and on behalf of the people of Gibraltar, and to exercise their rights to the freedom of the city of Gibraltar and to wear utmost peace, whether or not they give their citizens.
I now propose a question in the sense of the motion moved by the Chief Minister. Would any other member wish to contribute?
Mr. Speaker, yes, simply to associate the opposition with the words of the Honourable Defence and to confirm that we will be supporting this motion. He's absolutely right when he says that the text of the motion speaks for itself. Its content is very clear. And there's nothing really to add other than to point out, as a result of some research that I did in preparation for the motion, that it says that the name Gibraltar is taken as a crest and that the former remains there to the day in the Royal Anglian Regimental Crest. And also to point out that the Garrison Headquarters in Suffolk is also called Gibraltar Barracks. And so the opposition will be supporting this particular motion.
Any other honourable member wish to contribute to the motion? The honourable member of the
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I would just like to add one bit of the history of the Anglian Regiment that I don't think has been reflected. It was
quite some first-hand knowledge, and that is the when I did the compulsory military service in 1958, the 20th Infantry converted from being artillery to being infantry, and the Royal Anglian Regiment had somebody seconded to the Volta to convert us into riflemen or artillerymen with the weapon being damaged to be part of the regiment, and therefore they made an important contribution to the transition of the Volta regiment into what it then became an important part of the British army. And the only thing that they failed severely in was in converting me into a disciplined soldier. I was a veteran. And he was instrumental in preparing the first local Yugoslavian and locally enlisted member of the Yugoslavia regiment, and therefore he was elected through Bob Randall having become the first Yugoslavian regiment, which had a major thanks in many ways to the training given to him by the Royal Anglian Regiment.
I need to comment on all our members who have spoken for their support and to say that anybody who has been able to destroy Mr. Lassana or any such, whether even if it is just to go from artillery to infantry and not then to become a soldier, he suggested, deserves much more than the freedom of the city, and therefore the place is proven for the Royal Anglian to have this award.
And I put the question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable Deputy Commissioner. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. Honourable Deputy Commissioner.
I didn't really notice, but I wish to make a personal statement before the motion is here, before the House is adjourned.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Mr. Speaker, we were on the subject matter earlier about members of Parliament making themselves responsible for a statement that they make in this House. I have now had an opportunity of looking at Hansard, and it's simply not the case that I challenge the Honourable Minister of Sanity, Emmanuel Manuk. It was the reverse. I don't quite say that in any way criticising the Minister of Sanity, because from my point of view, that's a matter that is in the past. But of course, I need to set the record straight. If he wants me to read from Hansard, I can, but that is the position. And I wanted to know, it's so much that it's been a matter in the past, unfortunately, but actually, I view it as one of the executives in this House that I have personally taken from a light-hearted way and has lifted some of the seriousness what we actually see in this House. So much so that I have an article of from the press with his head and my head over two boxes and the article next to it on my corridor in my house. So there's no, I don't say this out of any first sense of spite or anything like that, but of course I need to set the record straight, Mr. Speaker, because I have had an opportunity to look at the answer. In relation to Victor Fellow, if in any way, if the Honourable Chief of the State and Mr. Victor Fellow wasn't there at the Madrid event, then I apologise for having mentioned him in circumstances where he wasn't there. I didn't mention him from a point of view of criticising Mr. Victor Fellow. It was just simply an example that I used from somebody that I thought was there, because I've seen photographs from the Volta Chronicle, but obviously, if I'm mistaken, I have absolutely no hesitation in withdrawing the reference to Mr. Othello for those of the two statements that I was making.
Well, Peter,
I don't know what it is that the other member says that he said, which is not verified. I think he just insisted that what he said he was the right thing all along, because his position is a bit hidden thing, because he's just about to tell us that he was right, I think. But anyway, let's take that remark in the way that I think it was intended, and move on from the matter. I'm delighted to hear that he has that picture of his own and the third or the we all look back sometimes affectionately and think that we said to each other in hopes and in disgrace, and we and this guy have absolutely no problem accepting that in that way, because in all of those cases, we've always won it, so it doesn't matter. But, Mr. Speaker, and in the sense trusting that the elder donor will be set, realize that we are not in fact simply we can afford the electricity, and we will be back here next month, and now move that the House will be into the idea.
I now propose the question, which is of the House in our against the media. And I'll put the question, which is of this House in our against the media. Those in favour, those against, but the House in our against the media.